Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
It was during such a drive that I passed Smitty's Barbershop, a 15 by 30 foot storefront on the edge of Hyde Park, with four barber's chairs and a card table for Letitia, a part-time manicurist. The door was propped open when I walked in. The barbershop smells of hair cream and antiseptic mingling with the sound of men's laughter and the hum of slow fans. Smitty turned out to be an older black man, gray-haired, slender and stooped. His chair was open, and so I took a seat, soon joining in the familiar barbershop banter of sports and women and yesterday's headlines. Conversation at once intimate and anonymous, among men who've agreed to leave their troubles outside. Somebody had just finished telling a story about his neighbor. The man had been caught in bed with his wife's cousin and chased at the point of a kitchen knife, buck naked, out into the street, when the talk turned to politics. "Verdoliak and the rest of them cracker aldermen don't know when to quit," the man with the newspaper said, shaking his head in disgust. "When old man Daly was mayor, didn't nobody say nothing about him putting all them Irish up in City Hall. But the minute Harold tries to hire some black people, just to even things out, they call it reverse racism. Man, that's how it always is. Whenever a black man gets into power, they're gonna try to change the rules on him. Worst part is, newspapers acting like it was black folks that started this whole mess. What you expect from the white man's paper? You right. Harold knows what he's doing, though. Just biding his time till the next election." That's how black people talked about Chicago's mayor, with a familiarity and affection normally reserved for a relative. His picture was everywhere, on the walls of shoe repair shops and beauty parlors, still glued to lampposts from the last campaign, even in the windows of the Korean dry cleaners in the Arab grocery stores, displayed prominently, like some protective totem. From the barbershop wall, that portrait looked down on me now, the handsome grizzled face, the bushy eyebrows and mustache, the twinkle in the eyes. Smitty noticed me looking at the picture and asked if I'd been in Chicago during the election. I told him I hadn't. He nodded his head. "Had to be there before Harold to understand what he means to this city," Smitty said. "Before Harold, seemed like we'd always be second-class citizens." "Plantation politics," the man with the newspaper said. "That's just what it was, too," Smitty said. "A plantation. Black people in the worst jobs, the worst housing, police brutality rampant. But when the so-called black committeemen came around election time, we'd all line up and vote the straight Democratic ticket. Sell our souls for a Christmas turkey. White folks spitting in our faces, and we'd reward them with the vote." Clumps of hair fell into my lap as I listened to the men recall Harold's rise. He had run for mayor once before, shortly after the elder Daly died. But the candidacy had faltered. A source of shame, the men told me. The lack of unity within the black community. The doubts that had to be overcome. But Harold had tried again, and this time the people were ready. They had stuck with him when the press played up the income taxes he'd failed to pay. They'd rallied behind him when white Democratic committeemen, Verdoliak and others, announced their support for the Republican candidate, saying that the city would go to hell if it had a black mayor. They had turned out in record numbers on election night, ministers and gangbangers, young and old. And their faith had been rewarded. Smitty said, "That night Harold won, let me tell you, people just ran the streets. It was like the day Joe Louis knocked out Schmeling. Same feeling. People weren't just proud of Harold, they were proud of themselves. I stayed inside, but my wife and I, we couldn't go to bed until 3. We were so excited. When I woke up the next morning, seemed like the most beautiful day of my life. Smitty's voice had fallen to a whisper, and everyone in the room began to smile. From a distance, reading the newspapers back in New York, I had shared in their pride, the same sort of pride that made me root for any pro football team that fielded a black quarterback. But something was different about what I was hearing now. There was a fervor in Smitty's voice that seemed to go beyond politics. "Had to be here to understand," he had said. He'd meant here in Chicago, but he could also have meant here in my shoes, an older black man who still burns from a lifetime of insults, of foiled ambitions, of ambitions abandoned before they'd been tried. I asked myself if I could truly understand that. I assumed, took for granted, that I could.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, March 25th, 2016. So I have been told. This is our book club, fourth installment, current selection, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World. We're picking up on page 81. Next essay is Media Ignorance is Showing. This is dated April 9th. 1983 for the first selection for this week. The audio clip you heard at the beginning of the program, President Barack Obama, his autobiography, Dreams from My Father. He too wrote extensively about the election of Mayor Harold Washington and the impact that that had on black Chicagoans. Interesting to get his perspective on an incident we'll be talking a lot about this week and throughout Miss McLean's work. With that, we'll get started. Audio segment number one, Leonida McLean, A Foot in Each World, Context of White Supremacy.
Media ignorance is showing. With admitted immodesty, I feel uniquely qualified to take on one furor swirling about the mayoral campaign, racism and media coverage. Some segments of the black community have labeled the media racists. Interestingly, the white community is decrying the negative coverage of Bernard Epton. You can't please any of the people any of the time in this race. Do I, as a black and member of the press, deem the media racist? They are no more so and no less than any other institution that is held by and caters to the majority culture, much to the neglect, intentional or not, of minority cultures. The other question from the black community is, are certain columnists and commentators racist? This is more disconcerting and not easily answered. I cannot read people's souls, not even after sitting next to them 5 days a week for 10 years. I have suspected a few co-workers of storing white sheets in their lockers, suspected a few more on the morning after Harold Washington's Democratic mayoral primary victory. There were a lot of taciturn people in Tribune Tower that morning who suddenly could not look black colleagues in the eye. Their jokes about declining property values were unforgivably insensitive, betraying a grave, deeper fear. But what makes a journalist's handiwork racist? Is it racist if a white reporter writes something unfavorable about Washington? If a black writes something favorable? Is it anti-Semitic if a black reporter writes something unfavorable about Republican candidate Bernard Epton? The hostility of the black community has come to this kind of hair-splitting, complaining about the mention of Reverend Jesse Jackson's name 3 times in an editorial that both congratulated and cautioned Washington. Editorials are by their nature opinionated. Reporting is different. For reporting to be fair requires facts that are indisputable, contracting the subject to allow a defense and care by reporters and editors of the use of judgmental adjectives. Journalists are just like everyone else. They can despise and ridicule and admire. Their special mission, however, is to put this part of their humanity aside temporarily for the higher good of an informed citizenry. everyone is the sum of personal experiences. Journalists are supposed to be able to sever the personal from the professional. Columnists and commentators simply have the luxury of not making so deep a cut. Blacks in the media confront this duality naturally. Are we black journalists or journalists who just happen to be black? We begin a step ahead in understanding because the culture from which we come is invaded by the other. It is not a two-way exchange. White journalists have not had to struggle in this philosophical quagmire as often because of a natural kinship with their primary audience. With Washington's victory, the media encountered the black journalist audience for the first time on the same level as the main audience. The media's racial ignorance is not dismissible per se as bigoted and malicious. It is a byproduct of unfamiliarity. The media, if they are any good at all, will find ways to be perceptive interpreters of the black community, and they have shown evidence of this since the primary. That professional benefit of the doubt should be extended to black reporters covering a Seder in Rogers Park, or a Polish politician's rally, or a Puerto Rican Day parade, or, more to the point, the Black Tribune reporter who covered Epton at the Southside Irish parade, where T-shirts emblazoned "Vote Right, Vote White," and cries of "Go Get 'em, Jew Boy," were the order of the day. The black community, and I no more pretend to speak for all of it than William Sapphire speaks for all pedants, has a good case in knocking the media for its racial insensitivity. Yet to cry racist on the basis of nothing more than a difference of opinion is counterproductive. In the wake of the primary, a black media coalition headed by Reverend Henry Hardy of the Southside Cosmopolitan Community Church has been forced to monitor coverage of the black community. It has the potential for doing good, but some of its missiles are misdirected at journalists who have a greater problem of ego than of race. Part of its focus is on employment of minorities in the media, which I would not be foolish or presumptuous enough to get into here. There surely is a need for more blacks and Hispanics in every business, and for more reliance on those minority group members who are positioned in companies. But let's be candid. This is my livelihood, and some business matters are best dealt with internally, even when there is a correlation to community dissatisfaction. Better coverage of the black community is imperative. As a black, I feel as left out as does the black community at large, and I am just as appalled by some of the media's off-the-cuff remarks, poll interpretations, and commentaries. I felt insulted by the sea of white panelists on TV primary night trying to explain a black phenomenon to viewers when they scarcely had a point of reference themselves. Yet as a journalist, I sought reasons to support my anger. Where there are inaccuracies, inequities, and inconsistencies in coverage, those of us within the palace walls who have the ear of the king must and do protest. Outside, the media coalition can best turn its attention to mobilizing the black community in letter-writing campaigns and in seeking rebuttals on broadcast stations within reason. It is not enough just to get mad, but to become attuned to get involved with, and to seek accountability from the media. This is the black community's obligation in promoting the two-way cultural exchange. As for the media, they are not immovable. They are perhaps more easily altered than most institutions because of the flow, indeed the bombardment of ideas. They will adapt. Individually, journalists with any integrity will find a way to keep their noses for news clean.
April 30th, 1983.
The storm has passed. This column was written shortly after Harold Washington became the first black mayor of Chicago. The fist fight that McLean mentions refers to a white voter who was charged with attacking Richard M. Daley, an unsuccessful mayoral candidate and son of the late mayor Richard J. Daley. The attacker reportedly was one of many whites who were angry that Daley had siphoned off white votes that would have enabled incumbent mayor Jane Byrne to stop Washington's victory. This town was not a jolly place to live a few weeks ago, remember? All appears to be well now. After the charged words, the debate about why it was or wasn't acceptable to say or do or write this way or that. Everyone's going on about life peaceably. Or are they? The fist fight between state's attorney Richard M. Daley and an angry voter says otherwise. Harold Washington's victory in and of itself doesn't buff the tarnish from Chicago, no matter how many votes he got on the Southwest side. It is hypocrisy to talk about the divisions and say in the same breath that the city did not deserve the label of racist or whatever watered-down word approximates it without offending. Just when the racial barriers had become worn, shown a crack or two, they were quickly tuck-pointed and the age-old misunderstandings that had never been dealt with inwardly or outwardly were sealed even tighter. Interracial friendships have been tested. Some have fallen victim. Many people have taken refuge in cleaving to my kind, and it will be a long time before they venture forth trustingly again. In desperation, the people and the candidates exhibited not their best, but their worst. People really showed their true colors in more ways than one. Everyone's emotions have been wrung. Everyone has had enough of everything, and yet nothing has been done to change people's hearts. There was a lot of talk, but no dialogue, no exchange. Everyone talked at each other from intransient, distant positions, never hearing what the other had to say. Whites don't understand black aspirations any better, and blacks don't understand white fears. And all of the unity luncheons in the world won't change that, not until people pray and live and marry and go to school together. Working together 8 hours a day isn't enough, but we have to try. We are supposed to be trying in the spirit of healing, though my lifetime will end before it's through. Everyone's talking about unity. It's going to take nothing short of a miracle to achieve, and a mayor can't do it alone. Where is the reinforcement to come from? The proud warriors of the Democratic Party? The business people who venture out now that the storm has passed? This is a task for everyone if the healing is to be in earnest. Before Washington's term is over, blacks are going to have to learn to disagree with each other publicly, to vote against each other if need be. Sometimes the best support will be contrariness, and whites are going to have to make leeway for Washington to counterbalance their biases. This is not a charge of racism. It is a statement of the facts of life. People of different races do indeed approach each other differently, with different expectations, different outlooks. This was apparent in the campaign. Blacks looked at this election as the natural continuum of the civil rights movement. Whites saw it as just politics. Now it really is politics. It must not be easy today to be Harold Washington. On the other hand, the newfound messiah of many blacks. On the other, the grim reaper come to pillage a vibrant city, and don't think the latter view does not persist. If he fails, he not only takes the city along, but the hopes of 26 million black Americans, not just the 1.4 million here. Washington has a struggle ahead, and very little help. After the prayers and thank yous, he'd better head for City Hall to try to persuade city workers that he will be fair. A great many won't believe him, will never like him, but at the very least, they should work for him diligently and earnestly. He is the head of this city now, and the hacks who didn't want to defer to him are going to have to swallow hard and try it. And so must he indulge them. A victor can afford to be forgiving, should be magnanimous. Smoothing a few ruffled feathers does not detract from his victory. Then Washington had better hit the streets again with 10 times the vigor he showed in the campaign, going into every neighborhood, whether he anticipates a throne shouting grateful adulation or the echo of an empty hall. The police stations will have to be a special stop. He may even have to go behind closed doors with police, the partisans who compromise themselves most in this election, and have a shouting match before there is calm. And after all of the symbolic gestures, he had better run this city the way he said he would, fairly, honestly, openly. He did not promise a black in every power-wielding slot, contrary to the most overblown hopes, the most irrational fears. And few blacks ask or expect that of him. Washington's most important promise was to make the city solvent. That has nothing to do with color and everything to do with good administration and political pull here in Springfield and in Washington. He needs a thorough, respected number two, a known quantity who knows every piece of legislation, every alderman and committeeman, every bond issue and contractor, every community organization's complaint, and every weak link. His top-level management team had better be better than his disheveled campaign organization. There will be friends and contributors to repay, as in any campaign, but appointments that turn into embarrassments may be irreparably damaging. No one will give him the benefit of the doubt of being changeable like Jane Byrne. The crusade is over. This is the real world. Words now must turn to deeds. It's your city, Harold Washington, splintered and troubled though it may be.
May 28th, 1983.
Pinpointing political motives. City Council drew new battle lines after Washington's election. Washington and his allied 21 aldermen faced off Alderman Edward Fast Eddie Vrytelyak, 29, which included Roman Pusinski and Edward Burke, the Alderman Errand Boys, to whom McLean refers at the beginning of this column. City Council meetings, which had been rubber stamp affairs under earlier administrations, now became argumentative and even vituperative. As a result, when the Cook County Regular Democratic Organization, chaired by Vrytelyak, held a party fundraiser, most prominent blacks boycotted the affair and held the alternative fete mentioned here. It's politics, it's race. It's politics, it's race. Truth is, the fractiousness in City Hall is both. It is naive to think it is all one or all the other. How much of the fight is political and how much is racial is where the true difference in opinion arises. The percentages are in the eyes of the beholder. My own percentages are generally 50-50, but this varies with every council meeting, court decision, or pronouncement from aldermanic errand boys Edward Burke and Roman Pusinski. Each faction in the struggle surely realizes this, and each has been showing the political card, but banking on the emotional racial card to win. Mayor Harold Washington, of course, doesn't have to show his hand. His constituency plays it for him. At Wednesday's Black Democratic boycott dinner on the South Side, he said, "They're trying to make this a racial conflict, a racial division. It's not that at all. It's good versus evil." He can afford to say that it's politics, almost in code, knowing the bulk of his supporters will maintain the "it's race" side nonetheless. The Opposition 29 try to keep the race card hidden, but their bluff is transparent. Their public stance is politics as usual. The dishonesty of it is that their private stance plays to their constituencies as much as Washington's, just being mayor, plays to blacks. It was that seer, Edward Vrytolak himself, who sorted out the psychology of this town as long ago as the February primary. He reminded his workers then, "This election is a racial thing." Now Vrytolak, 10th Ward Alderman, sees only politics. He speaks in code, too. It gives his constituency a chance to nod slyly in agreement with this publicly acceptable stance, knowing all the while the unspeakable factor of race is lurking somewhere. With all of this doublespeak, no wonder so many people want to oversimplify the squabble as just race or just politics. Those on the "it's politics" side are certain that the split among the aldermen is a good, old-fashioned fistfight with bloody noses, but no lasting damage, a prediction that could probably prove doubly naive. "Don't worry until city business comes to a halt," they say assuredly. "Meanwhile, let's just watch." This side also maintains that the power struggle would have occurred had all of the parties involved been white, had Washington been white and Vrytolak black, or had everyone been purple. And last, in this view, Mayor Washington just did not get his act together and was defeated by his own delay, his own ego. He was bamboozled by those around him, whose sudden promotion from outsiders to insiders pumped up their pride but didn't necessarily make them skilled political wheeler-dealers. The "it's race" argument reverses some of the other side's examples. First, if you're black, there is no such thing as a good, clean fight because the rules will be dirtied up every time. Blacks will never be convinced that a white version of Harold Washington, had he come charging in the same way with the same battle cry of "end patronage," would have been treated to such public insult. Second, perhaps Washington was given to a bit of self-delusion. Anyone else who had come so far, so fast, swept by a vast and unparalleled social movement, probably would have been seduced too. A victor ought to be able to enjoy his victory. The black community never said Washington was superhuman. Far from it. Each of his personal and professional shortcomings was listed so often during the campaign, they could not be forgotten. Perhaps he did weaken his strategy by not being more conciliatory. Here is a man who, after breaking with the machine, made it by jousting, by being contrary, and he does not lose often. He would not have become mayor without that stubbornness, without taking risks. These are not excuses for Washington. One can acknowledge these faults without excusing them as long as one notes the opposition's faults as well. He should appear more deft. but the other side looks all too deft in wielding a stiletto. Why do some people want to deny there is any racial angle? The question is best answered with questions. In a city where even park benches are subject to discrimination, how can race be discarded? Why is it so imponderable that those white voters who opposed Washington are reveling in this act of revenge? Why wouldn't they cheer on Bridal Yak's side to whip Washington into shape, to put him in his place? Why can't the angriest of blacks see the political angle? Because for most of history, politics and racism have been synonymous to black people. Even with new political confidence, it is not possible to sever that tie overnight. The next 4 years are going to be rollicking and racking. As long as there is a black mayor, just about everything is going to be simultaneously racial and political. Among the things that will separate us will be this fundamental disagreement about motive.
June 25th, 1983.
City's puzzling prudent poll. Thomas Keene is a former alderman who was sent to prison when Richard Daley was mayor. Keene, who even his detractors admit is highly intelligent, was Daley's parliamentarian. He succeeded in having his wife elected to his post while he was imprisoned and ran the ward from jail. The Shachtman decree was an anti-patronage court decision that sharply reduced the amount of city workers who could be hired or fired for political reasons. It went into effect shortly after Mayor Washington took office. Its restrictions were so severe, it compelled Washington to appeal to the court for more political jobs, an embarrassing position for him as an anti-patronage mayor. Reports that the mayor's transition team chief, Edward C. Bill Berry, threatened to resign because he could not get in to see the mayor, made a splash and quickly evaporated. Berry himself begged off from reporters' questions, but enough sources have confirmed the story. It is an unfortunate occurrence, but it provides a chance to examine the administration more closely. The study is revealing. First, it is unfortunate because Berry, former head of the Chicago Urban League, is a first-rate organizer. Everybody knows Bill Berry, and it was his familiarity with people from struggling social agencies to academia to corporate boardrooms that helped to shape a distinguished interracial transition team. His disenchantment so early in the administration's short but rocky life is badly timed, yet another stumble from which to recover. Second is that the incident collided with the psychology of unity that has marked black psychology for months. The scurrying to mend any crack in the works is an astounding sight. There is an incredible oversensitivity to any criticism of Harold Washington, particularly with the city council battle in midair. But the one should not be dependent on the other. To question Washington on one matter is not to desert him on any other. Yet even people close to him will not speak on the record about the directions he is going, or more correctly, their thoughts about where he is not going. And third, the Berry incident leaves you wondering whose counsel Washington seeks, if not the man he entrusted to construct the framework for his new government. Who does Washington listen to? Many people say, so long as they are not quoted, that he listens to Harold and to no one else. He himself said in an interview with the Tribune after the February primary. Asked who helps him make policy, the answer was, me. It apparently was not a joke. Harold does things in his own way and in his own time, says an ally. The staunchest of Washington's defenders are baffled by his inaccessibility. They point to his inaction on appointments to commissions, the police departments, and city departments. Why is he leaving the enemies entrenched? Yet everyone is quick to add that those he has named thus far are sterling. In fairness, the other side of this is that these very people would give him the business about the Jane Byrne revolving door policy if he named someone today and got rid of him or her tomorrow. Some supporters fret that the campaign's weakness and weaker personalities have been carried over into government. These people argue that because they care as much as they do about Washington, it pains them to see his image sullied, but they do not deny their impatience with him. Washington's famous no-shows and reluctance to politic by phone are far overplayed, but they make for a tangible measuring stick, especially when some of those left indefinitely on hold are among the powerful whose support should not be taken for granted. Why would he shun the national forum of the U.S. Conference of Mayors in Denver? A quick flight in and out to stay home and lobby for the state income tax. How many potential allies have been lost or remained neutral because the phone did not ring? Power brokers are power brokers because they know how to deal with people. Even among the 21, there is uneasiness, which Black Chicago should be reassured is not the same as dissent or betrayal. Harold has a legislative mind, says one. The implication is that, with Thomas Keene doing the choreographing for the 29, the mayor simply cannot afford to miss a step. This all points to the fact that Harold Washington, the man, is still somewhat of a mystery to Black as well as white Chicago. What kind of person is Washington? He's irrepressible, intense, single-minded, and has a strong sense of purpose, says Grayson Mitchell, his press secretary. He takes a long-range, strategic view of political problems, says Alderman Lawrence Bloom, fifth, a Washington backer. This is something different for people used to dealing with Chicago mayors. He's understandably and justifiably slow to make commitments until he knows the actors better. He's not interested in the immediate resolution just to avoid bad press. In a word, deliberate, says Quentin Young, who is helping to revive the city's health policies. But that deliberateness is a blessing and a curse, for it is being perceived as indecisiveness and, worse, insularity. Still, Washington's caution might succeed. I was on the other side of the campaign, says David Schultz, who was retained in the Washington administration as acting budget director. I saw her, Jane Byrne, characterized as precipitous, changeable. It's really interesting. I don't think the criticism of him is valid. He had some major hurdles in Shockman and the city council, but I think we're going to see an acceleration now. He doesn't rush to make decisions, continues Mitchell's defense. Sometimes prudence dictates patience, because some problems solve themselves. Harold doesn't turn around on a dime. He puts sound judgment over speed, and he advises us to do that too. He's very grown up, and he is not easily rattled. Deliberateness works in a deliberative body. It doesn't always work when you run a business of 42,000 employees serving 4 million consumers. And it may not seem a realistic strategy to use against someone whose nickname, for good reasons, begins with fast. Chicagoans may have to learn to be as patient as their mayor.
July 16th, 1983. This is the Black Monolith. It's the biggest political free-for-all in a long time. It's democracy in action. It's the Black Monolith cracked. It's the first congressional district primary race to fill the seat Harold Washington vacated when he became the city's top official. There are 18, count 'em, 18 candidates, 14 Democrats, and 4 Republicans. And yet with all of those people clamoring for forms or pasting over each other's posters on the limited circumference of Southside street posts, it's been fairly ordered chaos. The issues have ranged from getting much-needed jobs and social programs for the district to cutting the defense budget to blowing up the Robert Taylor homes with little variance in candidates' opinions. The biggest issue is Mayor Washington's endorsement of labor leader Charles Hayes. Washington's endorsement has met all manner of criticism, including that he twisted the arms of committeemen to line up behind him, that he doesn't want a representative as independent-minded as he himself was, and may even be plotting to retake the seat after 4 years of headaches running the city. Some people thought he should not have made an endorsement, but let the people decide. Some thought he should have made one sooner, sending a signal to contenders to stay out and saving the people from having to choose among so many candidates. Fact is, he has every right to endorse, and the people have every right to vote their minds. The two top contenders early on supposedly were Hayes, the meat cutters union leader, who won the endorsement of his old friend Washington, and Lou Palmer, the journalist and community activist, who did not win the endorsement of his old friend Washington. Palmer's strength is in his grassroots contacts. Some call him a rabble-rouser. He says he's doing for his people. He has been pressing for black political empowerment for years, and the success of Washington is seen as a byproduct of that effort. Just when everyone was settled in for a race between these two, some other heavyweights decided to lengthen the ballot. Alderman Marion Humes, 8th, State Senator Charles Chu, State Representative Larry Bullock, Washington Campaign Manager Al Raby, Attorney Lemuel Bentley, and Ralph Metcalf Jr., son of the late 1st District Congressman, all joined the race. And then there are the unknowns. Among them are Republican Betty Meyer, a white Hyde Park homemaker who frankly admits she doesn't have a chance but is enough of a patriot to want to bolster the two-party system. Democrat Hiram Crawford, an abortion foe whose platform is prayer and fasting and 2 Chronicles chapter 17, verse 14. Democrat James Sturtevant, who makes bicycles in his home workshop and who intends to take over the country with his fraternity, Delta Nu Alpha. Republican Diance Priestley, a community newspaper journalist and former pinup girl, and perennial U.S. Labor Party candidate Sheila Jones, fresh from the mayoral campaign where she honed her skills disrupting debates. Socialist Workers Party candidate Ed Warren, who also ran for mayor, is actually the 19th candidate. He did not file for the July 26th primary, but rather as an independent in the August 23rd special general election. Whoever wins, the victory will be anticlimactic to the exercise of individual thinking that is making some in the black community dyspeptic. This race has punctured black unity, but not all for the bad, and certainly not irreparably. If there was overcriticism of blacks during the mayoral campaign for sticking together, there would be none of that in this instance. This race shows that blacks can and will disagree, that they have reached a level of political sophistication that defies analysts and pollsters. Yet many blacks are supporting Hayes because Washington is, and take the attitude that we have to stick with Harold. This is a congressional campaign, not the city hall brawl, as even the mayor should know. At a rally for Hayes last weekend, Washington accused some members of his city council opponents, the Verdoliak 29, of contributing to Hayes' opponents' campaigns to undercut not Hayes, but him. He did not name names. Even if contributions are being made, there should be no quarrel with anyone's right to give them. The black community can deduce for itself the motivations. State Representative Bullock, endorsed by the Fraternal Order of Police, was quick to chide Washington, saying the remark was beneath the mayor. Alderman Humes, on Washington's side in the city council, called the charges a smokescreen to cover up for Hayes' lack of qualification. And State Senator Hsu said the mayor fabricated the charges. Hsu further fumed that the mayor privately promised his endorsement to three candidates but sold it to Hayes because of a $300,000 campaign contribution from Hayes' union. Too many observers are looking at this race as a measure of the mayor's control. What they will find, as the black community will, is that there is nothing wrong if the lid is not clamped on all the time. Unity really is more than skin deep. July 23rd, 1983. The second annual boycott is on. Chicago Fest is surely cursed. The mayor dropped it from the city's agenda for this year, at least because of costs. There were reports that the city lost $1 million on it last year, but the bookkeeping has never been verified. A deal by a group of private investors who wanted to continue it at Navy Pier fell through because of the mayor's objections to the promoter, Festivals Incorporated. Then, when it was announced that the event would be sponsored by the Park District in mid-August in Soldier Field with Festivals as the promoter, civic groups objected to the traffic congestion the fest would create, and later the schedule was found to conflict with the $35 million National Hardware Show, second largest trade show in town. That problem was resolved by scheduling the fest closed for 3 days during the hardware show and is now scheduled for August 10th through the 14th and August 18th through the 22nd. And the curse goes on. The Better Government Association has charged in a suit that Festivals was merely a fundraising auxiliary for Mayor Jane Byrne and that she transferred money to Festivals without council approval from a secret slush fund. With all of this against it, it was not surprising when the second annual black boycott of Chicago Fest was announced this week. The catalyst for last year's boycott was Byrne's capricious appointments to the Chicago Housing Authority. Black attendance at the event, usually about 14-17%, dropped to less than 1%, and many black entertainers canceled. The reasoning behind this year's boycott is similar, that many white politicians continue to disregard the black community. Yet this year, there is a complicating factor in such a direct action by the black community. It has elected a black mayor, and it did so, coincidentally, from a spark lit by last year's boycott. The election of a black mayor did not automatically bring a greater regard for black Chicagoans. Byrne is gone, but little else has changed. Indeed, the insults have grown worse and the politics more sinister by the Cabalocrats, as Slim Coleman, an uptown community activist, labels the mayor's opponents. A boycott will put the mayor in an awkward position, but the black community is so worked up that it had no other choice. The citywide coalition to boycott Chicago Fest was announced by Robert Starks of the Task Force for Black Political Empowerment. It includes 20 other groups, including the Council of Black Churches, representing 300 congregations, Chicago Black United Communities, the South Austin Community Coalition, United Black Voters of Illinois, and the Greater Roseland Community Organization. It should be plain to everyone, black or white, that Chicago Fest is now just another battlefield in the city council war. While attention has been focused on City Hall and three courts, the brush fire has spread in every direction, including Springfield. Chicago Fest is no longer Chicago Fest. It has become Eddie Fest. One can pick either Eddie, Alderman Eddie Verdoliak, 10th, or Parks Superintendent Edmund L. Kelly, the third Eddie, Alderman Edward Burke, 14th, is only marginally involved, but he is never far from the spotlight and surely will find a way to increase his role. Kelly accepted the Festival's Incorporated proposal not so much to save the fest or to make a quick $1 million for the Park District as to needle Mayor Washington. Kelly's rescue effort is another round in the mayoral campaign tiff that began when he and his 47th Ward workers made their once-in-a-lifetime defection from the Democratic Party to work for Republican Bernard Epton. This point, and the recent federal lawsuit on discrimination in park services and hiring, could not be overlooked by the black community. The Park District is the most glaring symbol of racism, said Starks, a professor at Northeastern Illinois University. It would be self-degradation to help maintain that machinery. There is no guarantee that the money the Park District collects will be redistributed to black and Hispanic areas on an equal basis. He said the coalition is seeking Hispanic support. This boycott won't injure the mayor or the city. It will enhance it because it will help to shift the economy away from downtown back to the neighborhood festivals where local vendors get some help. This boycott makes political and economic sense. Why should we spend money in a time of hardship? We have no money in the black community and no jobs. We'll do more good by attending those free neighborhood festivals. Why should we fatten the coffers of our enemies? The mayor cannot and should not support the boycott because he is the mayor of all the city. He cannot and should not aid and abet divisiveness, though Verdoliak feels no qualms about spreading hatred by saying the mayor has a scheme to blacken the city. Whether the mayor can turn down the volume is anybody's guess. The support he gets won't always be the support he needs. However, the mayor has done the most diplomatic thing he can do. He has wished Ed Kelly well. August 6, 1983. Spoils of War, Chicago Style. The city council dispute seems to spoil everything it touches, and it seems to touch everything these days. Up is down and down is up in this town since Mayor Harold Washington's election. The old guard now are the reformers, putting the screws to the reform mayor. The very people to whom reform was a curse are now championing causes they once viewed as poison. Otherwise, would they have outlined rules on distributing community development block grant funds or on accepting campaign contributions from those with city contracts? Aldermen who have not cared about budgets except to pass what was waived before them by past mayors suddenly are expert financiers carrying on about allowing enough time to study the budget, about the public's right to know, a public they have disregarded until now. If Mayor Washington were to announce that the sky is blue, the 29, no doubt, would pass a bill proclaiming it orange. He would, of course, veto it. His loyalists would, of course, foil an override. The whole matter would end up in court.
The feud complicated deliberations in Springfield. In the school property tax fight, the Chicago delegation split along racial lines, and it was the downstaters who helped put over a tax that affected only Chicagoans. Even in working towards the common goal of killing the RTA subsidy, the sides had divergent interests. The mayor's legislators trying to preserve his power, the legislators tried to aid Alderman Edward Vrytolak, 10th, protecting their patronage, and RTA Chairman Lewis Hill. Here at home, the very people who had fought the Shachtman Decree now are its defenders. No sooner did the mayor say he would not honor $8 million in back pay to city tradesmen than Alderman Edward Burke, 14th, jumped to their defense. When the mayor requested TV time, the opposition couldn't bear not being stars too. The Vrytolak faction has not even been able to resist making issues of garbage pickups or the mayor's inauguration bill. And Chicago Fest is a can of worms best left untouched. The motto seems to be, if it will embarrass or compromise or merely taunt the mayor, do it. For his part, the mayor has not helped by being too quick-tongued, resorting to insults unbecoming his office. Who is to blame? Everyone and no one. No side has a monopoly on truth or the public interest. These are warring politicians, after all. Besides, a few zoning or contracting decisions left unsettled, it has not hurt day-to-day city business. But can the city stand 4 solid years of hand-to-hand combat? Amazingly, the combatants find common ground on this question. They say the feud isn't all that bad, despite the verbal sniping, and that no permanent damage will be done. To hear them, it's all just politicians will be politicians, and everyone thinks the end result will be a real governmental body. To Alderman Roman Pusinski, 41st, chief negotiator for the 29, the real tiff has concluded, and his side won. I've seen no evidence that city functions have been hurt, only some pride and some ego. The committees are conducting business in an orderly manner. The question is, does the mayor really want an accommodation? The administration is becoming more and more identified with confrontation and turmoil. Freshman 29 member Alderman Patrick O'Connor, 40th, said, I think the council would be more than happy to put most of this behind them right now, but the politics of the situation won't allow them to do it. There might be some animosity, but I think the public gets an overly dim view. Most of the aldermen are quite friendly at the ward level. Former Mayor Jane Byrne had her fights when she came in. It's just a stage where we have to get comfortable and work with one another, and then it will be over. As for the mayor's side, Press Secretary Grayson Mitchell says damage will be minimal to slight. Already, he says, to call it the 29-21 rift is too simple. The more we move along, we will have a different constituency for each piece of legislation. The lines have gotten blurred, even during the hectic days of May. What was portrayed about the feud was not that serious. In the long term, it's not helping the racial problem. But as I watch the mayor move among the people, I don't see animosity comparable to some of the things said in the council. But one 21 member is concerned nonetheless about the racial matter. We could have begun to make some substantial progress in race relations, and that keeps us from dealing with all the other problems: education, housing, poverty. It isn't like he could turn it around. It's a long, long goal. But we haven't taken the first steps forward and probably have taken a few backward. He also worries that the TIF could damage the city's image with rating agencies or business people looking to locate here. And lastly, that the mayor is appearing not to get anything done. What bothers me is the opportunity costs, the failure to move ahead in so many other areas because the mayor is kept busy reacting and can't do what a mayor should do. For all of the talk about the underlying calm in the council circle, the outward appearance of venom and chaos is what is being accepted. Even much of the citizenry, the audience that the aldermen play so well to, must share the disgrace. The uproar shows no signs of abating and just might grow. It has been a sorry
context of white supremacy.
Ungentlemanly spectacle.
System of racism is certainly ungentlemanly, if nothing else. The number to dial is 641-715-3640. And the code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. The number again, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. If you want to dial in or if you want to participate and you do not want to use your phone, you can use the free VOPE line. Should be linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tiny.tiny.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Address again, tiny.tiny.cc/oneRace, and that is the number one. When you put that address in, click the link on the left of the page. It says free VOPE line. When you do that, it will open a small window on your screen. The top line is a drop down menu. Select the number that I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. The next line will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for the code. The final line will ask for your name. You can put in random keys. You can put in a real name if you're comfortable with that. You can use a nickname, whatever works. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. Should connect you to the live program. You should be able to hear us. It is the same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 6. When you do that, you'll hear the audio prompt to press the number 1. I will see your hand and we can get you on the line. If you heard the audio introduction, President Obama, the segment from Dreams from My Father, which is another book that we did in our book club years ago, way, way back, But I cheated and was able to get the pronunciation for former alderman, suspected race soldier, Edward Berdoliak, since he was prominently mentioned. If folks have any points on him, apparently it is Berdoliak. Lots of quirky names in this section. Well, I'm glad I'm not having to read it. And thanks to all of our narrators, brand new narrator this week, third black female listener who has pitched in to help us do the heavy lifting of reading Miss McLean's work. With that, we will hit the phone lines. All the folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to add in, feel free. We should have whoever the person is on the VOPE line, Thomas in New York, Raj, you all should be with us. I will nab other hands as I see them. Please do not wait until the last minute if you think you have picking up a little bit of background noise from our VOPE caller. I'm not sure if you are in a noisy environment. If so, if you can... maybe find a quiet spot. We can get your contribution. Also, please make sure you're not on speakerphone. That sometimes that just adds a lot of extra background noise to the line. Thomas in New York should be with us. Roz, I'll come back to the caller on the VOPE line, see if it's a little bit quieter.
Good evening, Gus. Good evening to all.
Greetings.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, sir. Thomas in New York, and man, I'm just listening to this, and it sounds so much like what played out with Obama. Just the tackiness within the Senate. You know, nothing can work good. Even problems amongst blacks. I remember the National Black Congress. Most of them stuck with Hillary. And they had to mend those ties, right afterwards. But just bringing back so many flashbacks to so many of the dirty tricks they tried on Obama every time he passed something. They would block it, and not just the Republicans. It was a little faction inside the Democrats, too. I think that kind of played out. And I'll mute my line for right now. I'm interested to hear what other people will have to say.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Greetings to you guys, to Thomas in New York and all the other callers and listeners. I agree with what Thomas was bringing up in regards to the attacking, trifling, and racist white supremacist behavior of these politicians. I found it very interesting on page 81, where she wrote, it's in the piece, Media Ignorance is Showing. She said, the other question from the black community is, are certain columnists and commentators racist? This one is more disconcerting and not easily answered. I cannot read people's souls, not even after sitting next to them 5 days a week for 10 years. I have suspected a few coworkers of storing white sheets in their lockers. Suspected a few more on the morning after Harold Washington's Democratic mayoral primary victory. There were a lot of taciturn people in Tribune Tower that morning who suddenly could not look black colleagues in the eye. Their jokes about declining property values were unforgivably insensitive, betraying a grave and deeper fear. I replaced grave and deeper fear with a grave and deeper racism, white supremacy behaviors. It seems to me that this kind of shows again her confusion, because when you speak of working alongside people and sitting with them for 5 days a week for 10 years, and you're still not, and they're making comments and they're doing and saying things within your presence that are showing them to be exactly who and what they are, but yet you're still trying to find humanity in these people and white validation in these people on such a level that even after all of that time, she's still confused. So again, it kind of speaks to her ability to, in ways, accurately describe aspects of racism, white supremacy, as if she has an understanding, and it's almost like there's a doubt in herself, like a lack of belief that these white people are who and what they really are, which to me speaks to her white validation leanings. And it's just kind of sad to see that play itself out. On page 83, she wrote, as for the media, they are not immovable. They are perhaps more easily altered than most institutions because of the flow. Indeed, the bombardment of ideas. They will adapt individually. Individually, journalists with any integrity will find a way to keep their noses for news clean. I just find that really interesting. thing, because there's very few journalists today that really have the integrity of the journalists of old, in the sense of there were times in the history of this country in which the media exposed quite a bit. I'll just use, for example, what's his name? The guy who, Gary Webb, who revealed the CIA connection to the import of crack and cocaine into black communities. That's just one example, but I'm just saying, in generally, if I look at Gil Noble like it is and the incredible work that he did over his time as a black journalist, just the ability to expose the negative aspects of society that are created, whether it's by the indirect or direct racism or racist government action within communities of non-white people. And today, I believe that what she's writing about here is almost like a misunderstanding of even journalism, because the history of journalism in this country was newspapers were utilized to set up lynch parties for black males down south and throughout the country. The media has been used to demonize black leaders during the COINTELPRO era, when black people were trying to fight for our human rights. So there's a misunderstanding there and a hope for, to me, journalism that I find very lacking. Today, you sometimes might find more truth just by watching a witness who happens to have a blog and talk about something they saw, versus a news personality standing in front of you on television telling you about the same event, and you're getting a skewed view because maybe some CIA agent fed them something that they told them to tell the public, versus another regular person who actually was there and might have had a cell phone and took footage or whatever it is, and that's giving you their honest opinion of what they saw without that influence. So that was just one interesting thing. This really had me a little bit perturbed. She wrote on page 84, "Whites don't understand black aspirations any better, and blacks don't understand white fears. All the unity luncheons in the world won't change that. Not until people pray and live and marry and go to school together. Working together 8 hours a day isn't enough, but we have to try. We are supposed to be trying in the spirit of healing, though my lifetime will end before it's through." So again, she's speaking to probably knowledge that somewhere down the line she was going to end her life. But also just the whole idea of her talking about black people marry. Oh man, I got nauseated immediately when I read that. And just that whole concept of us having to be amongst them, it again speaks to white validation. Everybody that I know that was elderly, from Dr. Ben to my father-in-law, all said without question that essentially segregation was one of the things that helped black people understand who the real enemy was. And that once black neighborhoods were quote unquote integrated, or we were forced to go to school and live amongst white people, the damage was just irreparable. And today the way that we mistreat each other is a byproduct of what we call integration. So just the whole concept of that was just like nauseating. And it really speaks to her misunderstanding of the system and how I guess it's just the mental damage that's done just trying to make away with people that have no humanity in them and no moral compass whatsoever. And you can just see the mental confusion that was going on with her, and just how she at one moment really understood what was going on and then would go right back the opposite way and just swing the pendulum as far to the other side as possible and speak about integration, which is really terrifying to see a black person do. There was a section briefly, I'm almost done, on 85, where she says, "This was apparent in the campaign. Blacks looked at this election as the natural continuum of the civil rights movement, and whites saw it as just politics." I found that very, very telling, because I find that when she said blacks looked at the election as a natural continuum of the civil rights movement, that's absolutely true. Just like when President Obama was elected, a lot of black people just thought that the mothership had landed and, you know, black Jesus was going to just turn America upside down. And I knew from the very beginning, and I said it, I don't expect much from him. I liked the visual of it, but I knew he wasn't going to do much, if anything, for black people, just simply because of the position he was placed in. She said white sword is just politics. I find that very telling, because politics is really nothing but warfare without bloodshed. That is why in politics they use military terms. That's the term campaign is really speaking to a military operation. And when you see the abuse of Harold Washington that she speaks about throughout some of these essays, and how they spoke of just severe mistreatment of him. It's psychological warfare, and it's a way of debilitating, mentally trying to debilitate that black male and stopping him from any form of successful mayoral running of the politics of in the city of Chicago. And it was really interesting that she used that term, because a lot of us don't think of politics as warfare, but that's exactly what it is. And if you just study the way, even with Donald Trump and the campaign that's taking place now, you can really see that it's warfare, just in the way people are dealing with Donald Trump, the way Donald Trump are dealing with basically everyone else that he encounters in a debate or in a news clip or at one of those events. So it really just leans to the fact that it's a military operation when you're going through a political campaign, and we have to be aware of that, because that's something that really plays itself out right in front of us, so we don't necessarily pay attention to it. And then the last thing I wanted to talk about is a couple other things, but I'll wait. On 97, she wrote, "What bothers me is the opportunity cost, the failure to move ahead in so many other areas because the mayor is kept busy reacting and can't do what a mayor should do. For all the talk about underlying calm in the council circle, the outward appearance of venom and chaos is what is being accepted. Even much of the citizenry, the audience that the aldermen play to so well to, must share the disgrace. The uproar shows no signs of abating and just might grow. It has been sorry, base, and ungentlemanly spectacle." And this really speaks to the psychological racist white supremacist terrorism that Mayor Harold Washington was under, to the point that he could not even do the regular everyday things that you know a mayor should be capable of accomplishing, which is exactly what they've done to Obama throughout his campaign. It just really shows how white people continue to do these things to us, because we don't learn and we don't look at history and see that everything they do is a repetition. They just change it. They might refine it a little bit more. They might change the jargon, but literally they've been on repeat for 500 years and just getting away with it with every single non-white group on the planet. And if we could just start really paying attention to these things, I always say, if Reverend Pinckney was aware of Ben Tillman killing Senator Coker, maybe he might not have allowed that white male into his church. If we paid attention to white people bombing a black church and killing four young children, we would understand that a church is not a sacred place. There's no place that's sacred from white supremacy. And as a result, they'll kill us anywhere. And maybe he might not have opened his doors to that young white terrorist. So it's just really about us learning from history, learning that what white people are really capable of, and never, ever fooling ourselves into thinking that the people that we walk around and we deal with every day are any different from the white people who terrorized and committed genocide against our ancestors 500 years ago. They're the same exact people. They just wear cleaner clothes, some of them. And I'll mute my line there. Thank you.
Right. Let's see. The caller 6190 should be with us, and I will double back and check the vote line as well.
Hi, good evening, Gus. Good evening, callers. This is Perseverance. Very interesting reading. Since we don't have justice, we have a system of politics, which I like to call poll tricks. And politics is as real as Santa Claus and the Easter Bunny to black folks. What I mean by this is, if a black man is elected or a black woman is elected as official, it's only because white people wanted him to take the office, for either taking the fall or blaming that black person for the mess that they made before the black person was elected. And also, I think that they allow black people to have offices just for the pleasure of seeing that black person fail, Harold Washington died of a heart attack while he was in office, and even after his death, they were trying to say that his death was related to cocaine, but they didn't find cocaine in his system. The only thing I think is real about politics, and I do agree with what Ross said, it is about war, but I think the only thing that's real about politics is a game that rich white people play against each other. They see who's going to control that particular territory, state, or big city like Chicago or New York and see who's going to be able to exploit and make money while they're in office. And I also think it's like a white man's ego, you know, let's see if we can get in office. Let's see if we can beat the Irish people. We could see if we could beat these people. Some of the names of people that I looked up that were in office are Cuomo, which, you know, father and son, like Daley, in Chicago, the Rockefellers, Nazi sympathizer Harriman was in office, Lehman of Lehman Brothers was in office, the Roosevelts, the Hughes, the Bushes, and all these rich white people who have made millions off American people, especially off of black people in the slave trade. You know, they're allowed to be in office and exploit people some more, black people some more. One thing I heard Neely Fula say recently was that, you know, because I used to always think of the Bilderbergs, you know, these elaborate Illuminati plots, and these people are running, you know, the politics, the CFR, the Committee of 300. But what I like that Neely Fula said, he said, you just got to look for the usual suspects, the usual suspects, which are always white people. So I think these fancy terms are just organized white people playing chessboard against each other to see who's going to exploit. I think that's all that I have for right now, but it was an interesting reading, and I will mute my line.
For sure, for sure. Caller on the Vote line, let's see if you have any commentary. Other folks want to chime in that we haven't heard from, you should get your hand up. Vote line caller, did you have commentary?
Yes, Mr. Renegade, I did have a comment. Really, I've just been listening, but I think what one of the most recent commenters said, I think it was Ross, really echoed with me. So I just really wanted to pivot off that really quickly because I'm just recently coming around from being less confused with racism. And the biggest thing that I had to overcome, I'm still trying to overcome, is something Ross just pointed out, which is just believing and accepting that just your average white person that you work with every day, your neighbor, because I'm surrounded by them where I live, and at my place of work, everywhere I go, it's just a huge proportion of them. I'm just accepting that these people are complicit. They are active in this system. And that's the hardest thing for, I think, all of us to accept, especially those of us who are still incredibly confused and those of us who are just coming out of that. And it impacts everything. And as soon as we can all accept that, and I'm still working on that myself, the easier it's going to be to overcome and find ways to neutralize the system. So I just wanted on that. I thought that was profound and incredibly true because I'm living it myself.
For sure, for sure. If other folks have comments, you should get a hand up and we can make time. Just don't wait till the last minute when we get ready to pivot to the second audio clip. Some of the things that stood out, even from the very first title that we got with the reading this week. Media ignorance is showing. And to me, it strongly suggests that when she says media, she's talking about white people. And it's a few points actually in her writing where she's not specifically saying that I'm talking about white people here, even further down where she says the majority culture. And even I hear that phrasing a lot, the majority culture or the dominant culture. To me, it seems like people are just trying to find a way to not say white people. That's who we're talking about, which is interesting. That could have been an editorial choice where they said, hey, make sure you do not say white people, powerful people at the Chicago Tribune and other places where she's getting these articles published. At the time, I'm sure they had, you know, great influence over word choice and edits that were done on her pieces, where she says on page 81, where she was having suspicions that some of these white people had white sheets in their lockers. To me, and I have brought this up on the program repeatedly over the years in terms of us not really having an accurate understanding of racism, nor an accurate understanding of what it means to be white, and really having kind of a cartoonish understanding of what we mean when we say racist, where it gets reduced to a Klan member. It's got to be some Klanish person or some neo-Nazi type figure, and not understanding just the regular everyday, as was just stated, the regular everyday white people that you see in a suit or a white mom with an apron and cookies, that these are the people that are responsible for the system of racism, white supremacy, the things that they do every day, how they're using words, what they're doing on their jobs. These are the people that are responsible for black people in Chicago having the worst of everything, as President Obama said, and living near toxic waste sites, as he also details in his book. It's not just Flint. This has been a long-running method of whites terrorizing black people, that it's the everyday white people that you are around. They don't have to be in the Klan. They don't have to be calling you a nigger every 5 seconds, even though there's a lot of that going on, too. But just not understanding what it means to be white, and or not being willing to accept that this is what it is. And as was stated already, just, trying to look for ways to get around that, or find a handful of good white people, put that in quotes for sure. When she goes on page 82, the first paragraph where she says, the jokes about declining property values were unforgivably insensitive, betraying a grave, deeper fear. I'm not sure what fear she thinks white people had. Now, if it's fear of white genetic annihilation, that would be one thing, but she didn't elaborate. I'm not really sure. To me, it is unreasonable. It is as unreasonable as the whites now who are saying, we got to take our country back. We got to make America great again. We had this nigger in the White House for 8 years and he's ruining everything. I mean, it is the same thing. If you're telling me that white people in Chicago were afraid that Mayor Harold Washington was going to mess things up for white people in Chicago, that is absurd. Like, just because he is mayor, whites are still in charge. He is not going to be able to do anything, particularly that the most powerful white people in Chicago do not want done. I'm sure that in the short period of time before he had a heart attack in office, I am sure that there was no way he was going to be able to make any substantial changes in the local structure of how white supremacy operated in Chicago. I'm sure he knew that. I'm sure a good portion of black people that were less confused knew that as well. But just when that gets suggested, I feel like unless we're talking about whites having a fear of white genetic annihilation and some sort of irrational fear that is not based on evidence or logic, and it's just really about white people's dedication to racism, white supremacy, and their total contempt for seeing a black person in any sort of position other than holding a mop or a broom or scrubbing a toilet, that they just despise that sort of thing, unless that's what we're talking about, okay. But I mean, in terms of white people having a fear, that just does not make sense to me at all. I would really have loved her to elaborate on what she was talking about, what she was seeing there. To me, it also seemed, and I've sensed this a lot in her work, like she's trying to be, I guess, what they would call from a journalist perspective, balanced in the way that she talks about this. Like she's trying to say, well, whites are culpable in this racism thing, but black people are culpable too. Like she has a lot of paragraphs where she says, but what makes a journalist handiwork racist? Is it racist if a white reporter writes something unfavorable about Washington? If a black writes something favorable, is it anti-Semitic if a black reporter writes something unfavorable about Republican candidate Bernard Epton? Just that right there, suggesting that black people could be racist. Black people are anti-Semitic. Just, again, not understanding what racism, white supremacy is, how it works. And I also think, and again, this also could be white editors, whites at the papers that she's writing for might be dictating to her that you need to write this way, that you need to write in a more balanced manner so that you don't rile up our readers and have them cutting subscriptions and that sort of thing. If you want to get published, you might need to write this way. Although she has enough comments spliced in there, and it's been repeatedly about white friends and marrying with white people, that I have some suspicions that, some of this could be her genuine views on things. Maybe not, but I have a slight suspicion, slight speculation that some of that could be what she really thinks. And also because she's made so many comments about feeling guilty, I think you might say, because she's in a better position, relatively speaking, than many other victims of racism, and questions about whether she's quote-unquote black enough, and if she will be accepted by black people, will she be rejected by black people? I suspect that some of that could be authentic in terms of how she really feels. Let's see, where she writes on, where she continues to talk about journalism, and it's almost as though she's feeling the need, because she is a journalist, that she needs to defend or speak up on behalf of the quote-unquote media, the white-dominated journalism. No one is subjective, where she talks about that, and it reminded me of Dr. Marumba Ani, where she has an extensive passage in her book, Yoruga, where she says that this is one of the great deceits that racists have perpetrated, getting us to think that, oh, you have to be scientific, you have to be objective, you niggers are always emotional about things, and you got to come to this and be neutral and unbiased, and nothing could be further from the truth, particularly with whites. They are always, always functioning from the political imperative, the political perspective of white supremacy with everything that they do, including journalism and how they cover things, what gets covered. That is always the case. And they've done a great job of tricking us about this. And I was thinking when she was talking about the Chicago Tribune and, you know, maybe that they're just unfamiliar, or just journalists in general, white journalists, that they're just unfamiliar with black people, that they're ignorant. Again, I've talked about this as one of the greatest myths of racism, white supremacy, that the problem is just that white people are poorly informed, that that's what's causing this problem. Nothing could be further from the truth. And within that same line of thinking about this is not whites just being neutral or impartial. With Chicago, we can just focus there. When Fred Hampton was massacred in Chicago and Mark Clark in 1969, the Chicago Tribune was a part of that terrorist act. They lied blatantly in the paper and promoted all of the lies of the enforcement officials that went in and did this unjust killing, and saying that, oh, these unruly Negroes, they were firing back at Chicago's finest police officers, and oh, what a disgrace, and they deserved what they got, and rah, rah, rah. And it took all these years for them to come around and say, oh man, we totally messed that up, and we totally did a disservice to the public and giving them wrong information. And then again, I could have cited more because there have been so many incidents that have happened with Chicago specifically, but just this past summer, it was the Chicago Tribune. They had that editorial where it was a white woman saying that wishing for a Katrina in Chicago that could wash away all the vileness and filth and we could start from scratch. And it was a big upheaval. And I think Wendell Pierce, a black author, New Orleans native, where he said it's not just this white woman who wrote this piece. This is an indictment of the greater media establishment that, hey, we will let this sort of piece ride. No problem. You have editors. You have people who read things before it gets printed in the paper. Nobody looked at this and said, whoa, I don't know if we want to be saying, yeah, we need a Katrina here that kill all the people, get rid of the niggers and poverty and poor people. Nobody looked at this and said, hey, wait a minute. Maybe we shouldn't publish this. Maybe we should edit or take this paragraph out or what have you. This is an indictment of an entire racist media establishment that was in place when Leonard McLean was there, continues to be in place now. A few other things that stood out, just the terms that are used, just in my view, reveal so much about her lack of understanding, our lack of understanding, because I see this widespread, but lack of understanding of racism, where she talks on 83, where she references this as being a two-way cultural exchange. Nothing could be further from the truth. Like, I remember earlier in my life people talking about racism, white supremacy in just that way, that this is an exchange and we just need to come and sit down and have some sort of luncheon and share ideas and have a diverse way of seeing. That's not what this is about at all. This is a power dynamic that we're looking at. On the next essay, The Storm Has Passed, this is on page 84. Where she again, where she's talking about these interracial friendships that have been strained, where she says that these are misunderstandings. See if I can get the exact. Yeah, where she says just when racial barriers have been worn, shown a crack or two, they were quickly tuck pointed, and the age old misunderstandings that never that had never been dealt with inwardly or outwardly were sealed even tighter. Interracial friendships have been tested. Some have fallen victim. Many people have taken refuge in cleaving to my kind, and it will be a long time before they venture forth trustingly again. In desperation, the people and candidates exhibited not their best, but their worst. People really showed their true colors in more ways than one. That last phrase, true colors, is in the Word Guide. Mr. Fuller recommends not using it. But just that whole paragraph, again, these are a lot of the same just tired and inaccurate cliches that get pulled out when people are talking about racism. And again, some of this, I think, could be the white editors in terms of how they wanted to phrase things. Sometimes I think this is us not wanting to offend whites because we know that they can do a lot to us, take your job, take your life, whatever the case may be. But it's just totally inaccurate. This is not age-old misunderstanding. That's not what's happening here. This is not about, oh man, my white friend and I, we were cool, and then Harold Washington came and messed up. That's not what this is at all. And in my opinion, that is super tacky to have a white friend in this environment in Chicago where you have got tons of black people in the worst of worst conditions, but I got my white friend. I don't have a job. We got poor schools. We're living in a toxic area, but I got my white pal. That white person is, as I said earlier, that white person probably one of the people to blame for why things are the way they are for black people in Chicago or wherever you happen to be at. This inaccurate thinking just gets promoted on a regular basis. The white fears came up again where she said that black people don't understand white fears. She also had a passage in here about black people having to learn to disagree publicly. That's just not been my experience. I'm unaware of a time where black people have ever had misgivings or been reticent to disagree with another black people. I think even sometimes that those become, you know, classic moments in black history, black people arguing and fighting with other black people, even continuing on out today. Yeah, the passage where she says whites don't understand black aspirations any better and blacks don't understand white fears. Again, I have no idea what is being talked about here. Is the election of Harold Washington, are white people now going to lose jobs as a result of this? Are white people going to be stacked up in ghettos on the South Side? Are white people going to be living next to waste dumps in Chicago? I don't think that was the case. I don't think that happened with the election of President Obama as in the White House. I don't think that that was the case. I just don't understand. And I think that that just promotes a lot of flawed thinking about what racism is, how it works. Last few things I'll get in. The Verdoli Act 29 is huge. And that's what I mean about power dynamic. I think she is going to give a little bit more detail about that later. But the election of Harold Washington was such a huge event. So many people have written and talked about this. President Obama, their studies, scholarly articles, even more content continues to be produced. They have documentaries on this. Depends on how much you want to dig and research. More continues to be produced because President Obama's connection to Chicago. He was there at this time and now he's president. And a lot of people, I think Thomas in New York and Roz pointed out the similarities between the two. There continues to be more research about what happened in Chicago at this period of time. That Verdoli Act 29 is huge because you had so many just undeniable. This is white people's dedication to racism and what they're doing in response to this black person, not just running for mayor, but winning the mayorship in Chicago, where you had white people. Chicago had not had a Republican mayor in 52 years. And you had white people who were strong, staunch Democrats who totally changed parties and went for the Republican candidate because they did not want this nigger as mayor. The Verdoli Act 29, this even went to court where they decided and ruled that, hey, you all have rigged this so that you can have a majority white council members where it is not adequately representing the black citizens of Chicago. At the time, it was over 40% black, but they had rigged the voting for the council members so it would be disproportionately white. And they ended up having to change it and it altered the numbers so that there were no longer that many white council members. But to have all, I mean, it's just like the Tea Party that you're seeing now and what you've seen with the Republican Party for the last, whatever, 8 years that it's been there. And as Thomas said, not just Republicans, Democrats too, or independents, whatever they want to be termed, but the exact same thing playing out here. And I think just in my view, with everything, if you kind of look back and dig into it, I think at times she is, Miss McClain, she is not being as accurate, being as correct in really indicting what whites were doing. This is not, I've said this consistently, this is not some dispute between neighbors where we're on more or less equal footing and we're just having a little tiff, because she used that word quite a bit. That's not what this is at all. This is totally unbalanced terrorism, where you've got one group that is totally abusing and molesting another group, black people, on a regular basis and in all areas of people activity, whether it's politics, journalism, housing, employment, all the way down where this is happening. And I think there's short shrift given to that on a consistent basis. I will pause there. I guess comment or question, if you all have anything else you want to get in, that's cool too. But I wanted to ask, are you all seeing the same kind of, I don't know if it's trying to be what they would call being balanced, where it's, I'll indict the white people as being racist, and then I'm also coming back and indicting black people as racist as well. Do you think that that is the editor's? Do you think that that, you know, could be some of her personal leanings in terms of personal attachments that she has to white people, not wanting to offend white people? Just if folks had any comments on that, certainly if you had other things that stood out in the section of reading that we did, that is fine as well. From the folks who dialed in.
So I think that one thing is she hasn't, you know, this is before the Wellesen theory and Neil Fuller's works. So she doesn't have a very clear understanding of the system. And I think that it shows. And also, I think what's left out is she's a writer for the mainstream media as well, in the big press. And like Mr. Coates, she's not going to really be able to accurately. I think a lot of her stuff, like you said, has been highly edited. So I think like him, it has to look like a two-way street. It can't look one way, because they're not going to accept it that way. They thrive on being victims or playing the role of the victim. And if you're not victimizing them, it's some way or form or fashion, they're not going to. You're not going to be writing for that paper, you know? And I think that shows a lot, too.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yes, I would like to piggyback off of Thomas. I agree. I think it's a little bit of 50-50, because it's definitely been, it has played out through the reading that she absolutely has issues with her treatment from black people. So I think that part of it is that it does rear its head in her writing, simply because she's still hurt and pained by it. So she's addressing it in the way that she sees fit in certain aspects. But in other aspects, I really feel like it's highly filtered through the editing process, simply because when she did the How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, that was probably edited as well, but she seemed to have had more license there. And with the backlash, I think they might have been trying to pull in the reins, or at least guide her in a direction that would look, quote unquote, balanced. And that balance would mean indicting black people as well, which in some aspects, I don't think she would have had a problem with, due to her feelings about being hurt and her feelings about anti-blackness she personally experienced. And in other aspects, I think it was editorially doctored in that direction in order to make the pieces, quote unquote, like you said, look balanced and not lose white readership. The other thing, when you were talking about her misunderstanding of the history of journalism and the media and how it was utilized to attack on black people and non-white people, it made me think of the Hutu and the Tutsi conflict, where the Hutus were actually using the radio to hunt down like groups of Tutsi people, and basically they were hacking them to death with machetes and shooting them. And they learned that from the Belgians, because the Belgians used to use both that same radio to hunt down dissident Africans who were trying to fight basically racism and white supremacy. So to me, it just speaks to, again, the worst aspects of our behavior came from what we learned from white people. And there was a section on page 87, a brief one, where, and it's weird, it talks about Vodoliak. It says, this election is a racial thing. Now, Vodoliak, 10th Ward Alderman, sees only politics, which I just equate with warfare. He speaks in code, too. It gives his constituency a chance to nod slyly in agreement with his publicly acceptable stance, knowing all the while the unspeakable factor of race is lurking somewhere. That right there speaks to, basically, she's describing rhetorical ethics. And if we understand that rhetorical ethics 6 is one of the major operating systems of racism, white supremacy, and creating confusion in non-white people. We will understand that no matter how nice a white person is, no matter how generous a white person is, no matter how much sexual attention they give you, they are supreme arch racist white supremacist terrorists, and they're going to perform it on you in every way, shape, or form, even when they're coming at you in the most seemingly benign way. And always walk around with that consciousness. I do it every time I see them, whether it's traveling to and from work or at the job. It's just something that I've noticed, and I pay attention to them. I watch them at all times, and that's something that I just learned. They are all terrorists. I don't care if it's a newborn white child or if it's an elderly white person. They're all the same, and they function with the same mentality and understanding, and pretty much it's white genetic annihilation all day, and they're going to fight us on that at every turn. Thank you, and I'll mute my line.
For sure. I wanted to check in the call on the vote line as well. If anybody else had comments, feel free. But even that Berdoli Act 29, and again, you know, the Tea Party, you all have seen everything that we've seen, the rise of Donald Trump over the last 8 years that President Obama has been in office. But I mean, if we're going to go the route that, you know, everybody is to blame and this is some sort of equal tiff between whites and blacks in Chicago at the time, can you imagine, can anybody even name an instance where a white politician was elected that black people did not want in office? And so then another group of elected black officials formed a conglomerate to block everything that that white politician attempted to do. I mean, this is like a gang, what they're describing. I mean, that's what racism is anyway. That's why they revere Godfather films and the mafia and that sort of thing. Al Capone, these folks end up becoming heroes because white supremacy is basically a gang. It's the biggest gang on the planet. But I mean, this is like a local level white gang, the Berdoli Act 29. And again, you can look, some of this is going to come out in the reading, but they're blocking his budget, Harold Washington's budget, and other things that he's trying to do. Anything, and she even has it in the book, anything that's going to make the mayor look bad, do it. This is the top of 26. The motto seems to be, if it will embarrass or compromise or merely taunt the mayor, do it. I mean, can you imagine a group of black elected officials being able to function in that manner? And not just these sort of things to get on your nerves and try to make you look bad, but I mean, also we can do policy things. We can work together as a political gang and block your budget, block appointments, and really totally inhibit you from being able to do your job as an elected official. If anybody can cite an example of this happening anywhere on the planet at any time, I would be well educated. But I mean, whites are able to do this all the time, to just be able to see this with President Obama. That's what I mean. We should use correct terms and always make sure that we highlight, emphasize the power. This is about white power. This is not white privilege. This is not about a misunderstanding. This is not a cultural exchange. This is not whites are unwitting or unknowing. This is about white dedication to terrorizing, dominating non-white people and a global minority, as Dr. Welsing would always emphasize. Also wanted to make sure I got in as well Max Robinson, because that was mentioned as well about black people. He just hit reading about Leonida McLean and her struggles and mental health issues. Max Robinson also had a lot of similar problems, black male journalist. In the 1980s, he was prominently featured. He was not a print journalist. He was on television as an anchor person. But he had a lot of the same problems being a black male in this position. I think he might have been the first black male at CNN. But I know Mr. Fuller has talked about him before. He is Randall Robinson's brother, scholar, author. He still teaches. I think he's down in the Caribbean now, but they are brothers. He has passed away. But that same thing, the mental health, black mental health, that gets robbed and eviscerated in the system of racism, white supremacy. Max Robinson would be another example, and kind of in the same time frame as Leonida McLean. Did vote caller, do you have anything else you wanted to get in, or are you satisfied?
Oh, I just wanted to, can you hear me?
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, yeah. When you asked about how the author sort of had issues with both white folks as well as black folks being racist, it made me think of one of your archive shows where you interviewed Chauncey DeVega. I was just recently listening to that, and one of the issues where you and he were discussing was he really wanted to attack Clarence Thomas. And to me, what you just described with the author sort of falls in with that, that Black people, we sometimes really want to not just put the blame on white people, but that we also have to share the blame. And again, Chauncey DeVega really sort of, you and he had quite a discourse in talking about that. And he really insisted that you cannot leave people like Clarence Thomas out because they're doing huge damage to Black people. And so your comment about the author and wanting to share the blame and saying white people are racist, but also Black people are racist, really just reminded me of that discourse. And it just helps reinforce the point.
Remember that one from the archives. Absolutely. Mr. DeVega. And a lot of times it'll be coupled with all of this, at least in my view, a lot of the vehemence directed at other victims of racism. It will be cutting racists a lot of slack. And I think I see a lot of that in this book. And I remember a lot of that from that specific broadcast where whites get cut a lot of slack. Tim Wise is an admitted racist, but he's doing a lot of good things. Jane Elliott is kind of cool. We can find all these white people that, yeah, they're racist, but that gets minimized. And in my view, that is just astronomically correct. That's not how we're going to solve this problem if we just continually let racists off the hook and decide that we're going to go extra hard on victims of racism.
Right, and I agree with you. It makes complete sense from a logical point of view. They're the ones with the most power, so why go after the small victim as opposed to the folks who are actually imparting all the damage and have all the power? So your point makes perfect sense. It's very logical.
Right on.
So I agree with what you said, Gus. You said, no Blacks have the power to be able to just form something on a whim and go against. But, you know, when you look at it, no other people on the planet got the power to do that to them. The Chinese, no one. I mean, the UN, no one can't go against them. I mean, they run the Security Council. I mean, they put themselves did a very good job of putting themselves in, embedded in power. And, it is what it is. I just wanted to make one more comment because this stood out to me, too, about the passage was even how similar it was to Obama. I remember when Obama became president and his seat went up and they put the Black guy in the seat in the Congress. They wouldn't let him in. You remember that? His Senate seat?
Yes, there was a big controversy about that in 2008.
And this guy, Harold Washington's city council seat even became contention. I said, man, this mirrors Obama to a T. Like, every little nitpicking-y thing is there, you know? And I'll meet my mom.
Absolutely. And President Obama was there while all of this happened, and he comments. Again, people, I don't know how many people were with us or have heard the archives when we did President Obama Dreams for My Father, but he was there. And so he talked about seeing a lot of this when he first moved to Chicago and, the racial dynamics of how this was playing out. I am not surprised. I just did a little bit of digging to see if anybody had written about these Black journalists together, Max Robinson and Leonita McLean. And actually someone has, Signethia Fordham. She wrote a paper, Racelessness as a Factor in Black Students' School Success, Pragmatic Strategy or Pyrrhic Victory. You can download the paper if anyone is interested. I could probably forward it to you if you are so inclined. But writing first about Max Robinson, she writes in a similar vein, Max Robinson, a Black reporter and one of three anchors on the ABC National News during the early 1980s, notes with bitter irony how his white superiors' perception of him as a raceless person was influential in his achieving vertical mobility within that organization. And this is a quote from Mr. Robinson, who's now deceased. One of the problems I have is that we tend to separate everything. So at ABC, Rune Aldridge, the director in charge of hiring news personnel, mentioned on three occasions, he said, I told you when I hired you, I didn't think you were Black, or I didn't think of you as a Black man. That's an incredible statement. I mean, I must be the funniest looking white man in this country. And the fact is, what he was trying to say, I'm going to give you credit. I admire you greatly, so therefore I will not think of you as Black. And apparently he said this on the Oprah Winfrey show. So I'm scrolling down. She also talks about Oprah Winfrey. So I'm scrolling down. Boom, boom, boom. So now she talks about Leonida McLean. Same report. Perhaps no example more clearly typifies the tensions endemic to the racelessness issue is the work arena that, is in the work arena than the suicide of Leonida McLean, a journalist and the first Black American female to be elected to the board of directors of the Chicago Tribune. Having grown up in a predominantly Black community in Chicago and subsequently having achieved enormous success in a white-dominated profession, McLean's sense of belonging and self-confidence were seriously undermined. To her white colleagues at the Tribune, McLean appeared raceless, indistinguishable from them. Close, 1984, suggests that McLean was committed both to the development of a raceless persona and to a racial integration as a social reality, and that she denied the existence of racism as an endemic feature of the social system in the United States. He cites as evidence a passage from a brief essay McLean wrote as a teenager. Why is there so much hate and contempt among people? I have never been blocked from anything because of my color, and I'm not ashamed of it either. My great-grandfather was Caucasian, and so was my great-grandmother. Fascinating. Why can't people just be people and live in peace and harmony? Maybe I'm in search of the perfect world, or maybe I'm just me. That's it. I'm me. But to be me is to be nothing. To be nothing is to be me, and I love all people, even pink polka-dotted ones with olive ears. After having achieved the success she sought, McLean notes the personal transformation and the attendant anguish she feels. I am burdened daily with showing whites that blacks are people. I am, in the old vernacular, a credit to my race, my brother's keeper, and my sisters, though many of them have abandoned me because they think that I abandoned them. I assuage white guilt. I disprove black inadequacy and prove my parents' generation that their patience was indeed a virtue. I remember this from the book. I can stop there because I think she just is quoting from the book now, but I will pause there. That is fascinating. I did not know she had white grandparents, although I can't say I'm totally stunned. 6190 is back with us. If anybody had any thoughts on the passage that I just read, or if you want to nab that essay, you can do so. 6190, you should be back with us. Perseverance.
Yes, I just wanted to say, I think the cognitive dissonance alone is what really created, her poor mental health state and eventual suicide. And I just have a question for you guys. It seems like Black people are very invested in politics and put a lot of energy into it. Do you think it's constructive for us to be putting that much energy and attention on politics?
I think in terms of what we mean when we say politics, I think Mr. Fuller would submit that, you know, anything dealing with people is politics. So, you know, you could even say that you, anyone attempting to have a marriage or raising children, that is a political act, just depending on how we define it. If we're talking about actually going to the polls to vote or picking a candidate, that sort of thing, I would submit on the local level, I can definitely see where you can have an impact. I know Karma has talked about that quite a bit in trying to get local things, particularly if you're in an area that has a sizable population of Black people. I can see where you might be able to do some things. I'm even reminded locally in Chicago, if we want to stick with that city, I think Anita Alvarez, the prosecutor there, who I think took an inordinately long time to bring prosecution in the Laquan McDonald case. She just got voted out of office. I think some people might submit that that is an act of Black self-respect and constructive. So I definitely would say if that's the form of politics that we're talking about, I could certainly see on a local level where that could have some constructive results. You might be able to do some things that benefit, but I certainly don't think that it's going to be able to change racism, white supremacy. Now, if we're talking larger scale, like I'm going to go out and, you know, support Bernie Sanders or Hillary Clinton, I don't see that as black people being able to do as much where it's going to have a tangible real world impact on your day to day existence. I could be incorrect about that. I'm not, you know, suggesting that people not vote for larger things or participate in the larger process. But it just it seems like that is heavily dominated by whites. I just don't see on a larger scale, national scale, where it's going to have that much of a real impact on what we're experiencing day to day. Did that answer the question?
You did. I guess maybe I was more or less thinking of what I hear or see on Facebook, the back and forth about Bill Clinton and what he said about Obama and Hillary's comment and Bernie Sanders' hair. And I just hear people, you know, having these kind of talks. And to me, it doesn't seem constructive. But what you said sounds constructive.
Yeah, I think Thomas in New York has said, you know, if you're watching that to study the political theater of racism, white supremacy, and whites watching this with an understanding that whites, the most powerful whites, probably made a decision about who's going to win this election months, if not years ago, and this is just how the process unfolds. If you're watching it from that perspective and to study racism, white supremacy in this process, I could see that. But I mean, if it's, you know, Bernie is my guy and blah, 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 and that sort of thing, I'm, you know, I'm less inclined to believe that that is a constructive investment of time.
All right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
But I will say Trump is my guy.
Right on. Right on. Right on. Dr. Wells.
Good luck with that.
Did anything stand out about the passage I read from the essay really quick on Max Robinson and Leah Anita McClain? I did, as I said, I did not know she had white grandparents, even though I'm not stunned about that. But anything stand out in that, or folks satisfied with that?
What stood out to me about it was when we found out that she did have white grandparents, because to me, it seems to me like she, even though she identifies herself as black, it seems like she kind of might look at herself as a byproduct of miscegenation is what I call it, but I guess race mixing in her mind, because she's written about it multiple times throughout the book, that she believes that we should marry them and whatever that whole nonsensical thing is. But I think because she might possibly see herself as a byproduct of such race mixing, that that seems to me what makes it easier for her to embrace that ideology. And it's not to take away from her blackness. Like I said, she identifies herself as a black female, so I respect that. But I'm just saying there's somewhere in there, it seems to be, even on the genetic level, it's expressing itself in this confusion and her inability to understand, like you said, what it means to be white. And just the whole ideology of that. And sadly, like Thomas was saying earlier, that was not a time where Dr. Welsing's work was, you know, accessible, or Mr. Fuller's work was accessible. So definitely she didn't have the understanding that I think she would have needed to maybe potentially stave off committing suicide like she ended up doing.
We got to get to the second audio clip, but I was thinking where it said in the report that Leonina McClain, that she was race neutral and, you know, just presented herself as quote unquote raceless. I'm indistinguishable. I'm not coming in. And even some of that has come out in the reading where she's, you know, questioning, am I a black journalist or am I just a journalist, where I can see some of that. To me, and most of the reading that we did this week was a few months before she wrote that piece, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites. The last piece that we read before the audio stopped was about a month after she wrote the piece, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate, well, actually just a few weeks after she wrote that piece, and a year before her suicide, just to kind of keep that framed. If that's accurate, her having white and its great grandparents, if that influenced her identity to the point of, hey, I'm raceless and we're just all trying to get along and have these white friends and all of that, that's the route that I'm trying to go. If the election of Harold Washington, if that revealed enough truth about what it means to be white and how white people saw her, that even though I have white great grandparents and I've accomplished a lot academically and I have a great job and a great house and I live around some white people in the Hyde Park area and all of that, and I'm trying to present myself as race neutral or raceless, And just, hey, let's all get along and intermarry and be friends and we'll work this out. And the white dedication to white supremacy came through clearly, undeniably, with the election of Harold Washington. That, I can believe, would have an astronomical and detrimental impact on her mental health, which could have greatly contributed to her suicide less than about a year after she wrote that piece, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites. If that was her psychological makeup at the time and everything that was revealed with Harold Washington being in office, that I could see that being very logical. If folks want to comment on that, give other thoughts, you can ponder on it during the second audio segment. We will pick that up. If you did not get to contribute or had other thoughts, just jot it down, make a note. We should have time. We're picking up page 97 in the book, the article, A Corner Tavern Fight in the City Council. This is from October 2nd, 1983. Context of White Supremacy audio segment number two. October 2nd, 1983.
A Corner Tavern Fight in the Council. One of the rawest, rowdiest city council meetings in the history of Chicago took place Wednesday, September 29th, 1983. In it, Alderman Edward Vrideljak baited Mayor Washington by looking up at the mayor, his hands clasped as though in prayer, and saying, "Please, Mr. President, point of order, please. You are improving by putting please in front of what you say," the Tribune reported Washington as replying, "but you haven't gotten there yet. To someone of your gender, I should say pretty please," Vrideljak said, his voice raising to a falsetto. Washington angrily retorted, "You're about to get a mouthful of something you don't want." Even for the Chicago City Council, this was not business as usual. "That does it. Anyone who gives me that highbrow analytical garbage today about how the City Council brawling will lead to a polished, astute, deliberate, representative legislative body will be met by icy silence." Last week's exchange in the council chambers between Alderman Edward Vrideljak, 10th, and Mayor Harold Washington was as lowbrow, as corner tavern, as the fight has gotten. Anyone from any ward should be offended. For all of his millions, Vrideljak still must have enough good, old-fashioned Southside dirt beneath his fingernails to recall how such a remark involving sexual innuendo used to be settled with fists in the alley around the corner. Alderman Edward Burke, 14th, remembered, and he surely has no dirt under his fingernails. He yelled to the mayor, "Come on down here on the floor." The mayor shot back, "Come on up," before calling a recess for 5 minutes. Although Vrideljak, who instigated the incident, and the mayor, who fed it with his response, tried to laugh it off later, they meant every word. There was nothing funny about it. Nothing. Aldermen sitting guard in front of their precious committee office and changing the locks on the door is funny. So is calling a mayoral aide to testify about the mayor's filming a movie with high school students in council chambers. But last Wednesday's exchange did not tickle my funny bone, as it did for some tittering aldermen. If some people would stop laughing long enough, they could see the implication of this. The city is in for a bloody 4-year war. These people are not playing. Their antics will provide great news copy, but in the meantime, every Chicagoan is going to be living on edge. It has been said over and over that this is the way government operates everywhere. So why the big deal about the council fuss? Chicagoans have been drugged by tight-fisted control for too long, this argument goes. Members of Parliament rail at each other all of the time, and so do aldermen. This theory would be acceptable except for one prime fact. This is happening to Chicago's first black mayor. Race is going to be read into it, and you don't have to be black to think so, to know so. Stooping this low is unforgivable. There is a deeper and dangerous psychological factor at play in the council wars, especially when the fighting gets this dirty. Any reform mayor would have had a battle on his hands, but Mayor Washington's foes are emboldened in their sniping because of his color. This is the way it is in this world. Whether whites can see it or not, or admit to it or not, they are ingrained by this society with a superior attitude towards blacks that is as natural and reflexive and uncontrollable as sneezing. That means that a black mayor is fair game for the most vile public insult, as Vital Yak showed. The very office of mayor should demand some respect. His foes respect the office all right. They respect it so much that they don't want to give it up. And to have to give it up to a black man, one with brains and political panache at that, makes them break into a sweat. This is what binds many in the 29. The council is still dotted with crooks and hacks on both sides who suddenly became legislators after Washington's election. They probably called Mayor Jane Byrne a shrew, or worse, in her early feisty days, or called Michael Blandick a wimp. But it was done behind their backs. Sexism against Byrne is yet a valid topic. Vital Yak's remark is sickening for another reason. It is the kind of reprehensible locker room blathering that is disgusting in that setting and entirely out of order at a public meeting. The council battle, even in its tenser moments, has been informational. Voters who only suspected their elected officials of being dolts have been given proof in some cases. Still, citizens with any decency and courage, whether 29ers or 21ers, should press for an end at least to the cheap shots while we're on the road to this brave new world of legislative sophistication.
October 30th, 1983.
Washington's electrifying elocution. Mayor Harold Washington either needs an interpreter or he needs to have his mouth washed with soap. Yet for all the flaps about his public statements, you cannot deny that there is a cadence, a flair in his elocution that has been missing in the last two mayors. Whether you like or detest what he's saying, not since Richard J. Daley has there been a more quotable mayor. Daley was quotable by mishap. Washington is by design. He revels in using language to jest, to fence, to demolish. When Washington called state legislators antediluvian during last session's tax fight, he sent an awful lot of people to their dictionaries. And scurrilous and spurious are part of his theme song. He would be great in a pulpit or at a college lectern. The problem is, he isn't a preacher or a lecturer. He is a mayor. And what he says is often inappropriate for his position. The famed doo-doo remark in describing a proposal by the council opposition is one example. Another example of how his language gets him into trouble is the varying interpretations of his off-the-cuff remarks about whites and the media not understanding him. Every politician is required to have a spat with journalists. The mayor was on target about the cultural unfamiliarity, but that would apply to blacks about Ukrainians too. Everyone has private mannerisms, phrases, and habits they display at the family dinner table, but would not display at a dinner party. Public figures especially have to put their personal style aside. To put it bluntly, The mayor should know better. And the element of race that he must be continually aware of should make him think twice. He should keep this in mind, in particular, for black audiences, even knowing there are certain things they want to hear from their first mayor because of the larger audience that eventually will hear or read his words. It's a quandary that his tongue gets him in trouble as often as it does, because any black person who has succeeded at anything in this world should be well schooled about putting on a social face. Beyond this, however, there really is a cultural failure to communicate, a literal difference in use of language between blacks and whites that is based on more than dialect or slang. It has been analyzed in a book, Black and White Styles in Conflict, by Thomas Kochman, a University of Illinois at Chicago professor of communication and theater. Reading it just might help blacks and whites in the media in understanding the mayor. Through years of observation of interaction of black and white students in the classroom, Kochman shows how language compounds racial divisions. Among his data are that interruption of another speaker is unacceptable in debate among whites, yet perfectly all right among blacks. That if the volume of debate rises, whites perceive a threat, while blacks just see an exciting exchange. That in white culture, to go so far as to voice a threat means that the next step is carrying it out, while just voicing it is a sufficient release for blacks. That whites do not mind direct personal questions on the first meeting, but blacks do. And that a white wrongly accused will rise to defend himself, while the black view is that to protest too much affirms the guilt. Kochman's ideas may seem like so much psychosocial pap. Whites could see it as an excuse for black behavior. Blacks could see it as perpetuating the stereotype about being loud. But he offers enough of his own and others' research and other researchers' evidence to make a convincing case. One of Kochman's theories is especially applicable to the varying interpretations of the mayor's white media remark. Kochman writes, accusations or allegations like men are sexist or white people are racist are understood by white people to be categorical. All individuals who fit the generic criteria feel themselves accused, whether they are guilty or not. Consequently, if those making the statement do not intend to be all-inclusive, they are expected to qualify the statement at the outset. Among blacks, accusations or allegations are general rather than categorical. They are not intended to be all-inclusive. Furthermore, the determination of who is to be included is not the responsibility of the person making the statement, but of those whom the statement might conceivably describe. Because all whites who fit the generic criteria feel themselves accused, not just those who are guilty, those who regard themselves as innocent will demand redress from the accuser. Within the black cultural perspective, however, there can be no inadvertent hits. For people to admit that they feel accused is, by that fact alone, to acknowledge their guilt. Kochman's theory was proved at a city council press conference in which reporters pressed the mayor for the most picayune specifics as to which whites in the media he was accusing. They all felt accused. But enough talk about talk. With all due respect, Mr. Mayor, please hush your mouth.
November 16th, 1983.
Robinson's brief CHA honeymoon. The rice hasn't landed at his feet yet, but the honeymoon is over already for Renault Robinson, chairman of the Chicago Housing Authority. The malfunctioning elevators remain his most serious calamity, but the list of other failures is long. Robinson has dueled with CHA commissioners over a $14,000 car, and one commissioner has resigned. He has riled community groups and aldermen about keeping secret the sites for scattered housing. Tenants are threatening a rent strike, and the Federal Department of Housing and Urban Development has sent in an overseer for the first time. It has been an eventful few months for Robinson, but as much as he has botched it so far, it would be premature to toss him out. When the time comes, Robinson, the mayor, and everyone else will know it. This is not to make excuses for him. If one were trying to make a case against him, steering the purchase of his automobile through the board would be enough. His irresponsibility with regard to tenants is damning indeed. When he was named, Robinson was seen by tenants as their salvation. They were positively delirious, hugging and kissing him. He was a man of the people, after all, so everything would fall into place. But it did not. First, the man of the people wanted a proper auto. "Take the bus like we do, brother," was the advice of some angry tenants. Now, one should not begrudge Robinson wanting a car, even though he begrudged his predecessor having one. The offense came in the way in which he went about getting it, which was buying it first and asking for the allowance later. And it was none too prudent to chastise in public the two commissioners who voted against it the first time, resulting in a tie vote that temporarily shelved the idea, and then wishing them a swift exit from the authority. One, Patrick Nash, did just that. It was bad form on Robinson's part. But the elevators are the critical issue. A CHA spokesman said the firm now trying to break the elevator curse will have at least one car in each high-rise building in good working order within 30 days. Promises, promises. The lesson in all of this is that salvation doesn't come in any particular color. Yes, Robinson does indeed have a special understanding of being black and poor, but that does not necessarily lead to the reasoning that these traits make him a more responsive chairman. What is evident in the CHA battles is that both sides are learning to operate in the real world. The growing demand for black officials to deal with complaints of black citizens is not always the best or fastest way to bring about change. As angry CHA tenants are discovering, in spite of the historic dearth of such officials, being black and making mistakes are not mutually exclusive. At one board meeting, Commissioner Leon Finney reportedly chided residents, saying, "I don't see them doing this to former chairman Charles Swibel or Andrew Mooney." Could it be there is a double standard, a different set of rules by blacks where black officials are concerned? It is not fair of tenants to expect the world of Robinson because he is black, or to expect that he would not want a car like any other official. But neither should he or Finney expect special dispensation from tenants because of color. It is a healthy family spat, and there is no disgrace in it because the white neighbors are eavesdropping. Some of these problems were not of Robinson's making. He may well be swimming as fast as he can. They were the making or inheritance of white administrators who were lambasted too, sometimes more harshly. But the problems are also the result of some tenants' indecencies. There is enough blame for everyone. It is assumed most tenants wanted Robinson. Now they have him. And while they have every right to grouse, to organize rent strikes or whatever, they should be mindful that the choice was made with their initial blessing and, I think, in their interest. As for Robinson, he has quickly discovered the difference in trying to tell someone how to run the agency and actually running it. He will sink or swim in short order, but first things first. He had better get the elevators running.
November 27th, 1983.
The real secret weapon of the GOP. The not-so-secret weapon of the Republican Party may be Edward Rydalyak, but the best-kept secret weapon is Harold Washington. He has brought a resurgence to the Grand Ole Party that should make Ronald Reagan both grateful and envious. What power Washington must possess to have gotten tens of thousands of stalwart Democratic voters to defect to the Republicans last April, including many aldermen and Park District Superintendent Edwin L. Kelly, Democrat or die, 47th Ward machine. Washington even moved Jane Byrne to flirt briefly with the idea of converting after losing to him in the party primary, and he might be the inspirational force behind former police superintendent Richard Burzak's switch to the GOP in his current bid for state's attorney. And now Washington even has the Cook County Democratic Party chairman himself reconsidering his political loyalties. It was revealed last week that the mighty Rydalyak trembles so at the thought of Washington that he actually went to the White House last summer to get help from the opposition. Meeting with White House Chief of Staff James Baker and Political Director Edward Rollins, they talked about the career plans of presidential candidate Walter Mondale. Rydalyak reportedly offered to get Mondale an early endorsement, then to discourage his faithful precinct workers from getting out the vote so that the president would show well. It was a classic move by Fast Eddie, wheeling and dealing more nimbly than usual until he got caught. One motive behind his scheme may have been to fix the National Democratic Party for having had the audacity to come into town to help Harold Washington's election to the mayor's chair, even when true blue and white Chicago Democrats knew better. There also was the matter of a little stipend, just to keep up a Chicago tradition, and that's where the deal was squelched. The Rydalyak caper was not just politics, although he is a political creature through and through. There is something other than the council power play driving him, something other than an attempt to make a few bucks, and certainly something other than the interest of the party. That same something drove Chicagoans, who have been Democrats since birth and who probably will be in the afterlife given the city's legendary vote padding, to turn away from Washington last April. What is so awesome about Harold Washington's presence that he turns Democrats to Republicans as the mythical Medusa turned people who looked upon her to stone? Could it be something about the way Harold Washington looks, too? Face it, Chicagoans, there is something about the way Harold Washington looks, and you only get one guess as to what it is. That Harold Washington is one Sharpie recruiting so many white people for the GOP, and all in one year. And white is apparently what Republicans want. At the recent meeting of the Republican Governors Association, members were urged not to waste their time to pursue the black vote, but to go after Hispanics, Asians, and white ethnics. Illinois Governor James Thompson told the gathering his black votes last November were inconsequential. That is, inconsequential in number, not in importance, he quickly recovered. But Mayor Washington is one black person who must be of consequence to the GOP with his effortless drive to increase their roles. If you didn't know better, you'd think Washington had beat even Fast Eddie to the Republicans and cut a deal. You think he is being paid not to change the way he looks so that more white Democrats will defect to the GOP. But he is kindly providing his skin color free of charge. Or maybe Washington is paying off the folks at the White House to ensure that the president and his party continue to make inane statements and look convincingly contemptuous of black voters. But they usually provide that for free, too. The possibilities are infinite. So, too, is Vratilyak's luck and control over the local party, it seems. After the plot was revealed, Vratilyak's supporters defeated a motion to censure him, not knowing a double cross when they see one, or not caring so long as it's a double cross of the right color. The Republicans are welcome to the lot of them.
December 4th, 1983.
The County Democrats, Titanic. It is a terrible, horrible, lousy thing when we put color first instead of qualifications. That bit of profundity came from no less a defender of liberty, equality, and fraternity than 10th Ward Alderman and Cook County Democratic Party Chairman Edward Vratilyak after the party's slate-making session last week. The outcome of that session was a county ticket that tossed in a few blacks for show, but for little political substance. It was denounced by black ward committeemen, who hustled off to try to draw up their own slate within the two-week filing deadline for the March 20th primary. That action, of course, will be called playing on race, as if the guitar had not been strummed already. Why is it that ethnicity was fine in the days when the ticket had its quota of Irish, Italians, Germans, Poles, or whatever, but not now when blacks want in? Suddenly, it's qualifications that count. Come on, we're talking tradition. Except that blacks know all too well how traditions are disavowed in a split second when they begin to take advantage of them, qualifications or no. In the scheming of smoke-filled rooms, last week's slate-making machinations will take some time to fumigate. But the truth about who did what to whom doesn't have to be told for you to surmise that there are an awful lot of old-style politicos caught in their skin color who would gladly make a deal except for the racially charged times in the city. What do you do if you're a committeeman, white or black, who is used to playing along and getting enough to take care of your people, and suddenly you're with one faction or the other by birth? Lots of black committeemen are finding out that they have had limited partnerships in the party. Alderman Wilson Frost, 34th, is one. He got the slate-making session going by seeking the Recorder of Deeds office, and many in the black community wondered briefly if he was betraying the mayor. But by the time the slate was drawn, Frost was absent from it and looking strangely like a tragic figure, again at the hands of Vratilyak, who had been described as an old buddy of Frost's. With friends like that, why would Frost want to be Recorder of Deeds? Remember, Frost is someone who has played poker with Vratilyak before he won, when he relinquished claims on the mayor's chair after the death of Richard J. Daley and was chosen finance committee chairman. This year, circumstances and skin color have made him an outsider. He had a rough re-election against a newcomer and lost the finance committee. Maybe he wanted some place to hide where there are 300 jobs to be dealt out and a way to be dealt into the game. Now that's tradition. Frost defended himself Friday, saying he wanted the post because of the principle and the symbolism of it. He said blacks were promised the post before, 4 years ago, but he apparently wanted on the ticket without assuring that he would support the full ticket. You could ask what brand of loyalty that is, except that last April, other members of the regular Democrats were pretty selective about whom they supported, and party affiliation made no difference. What on earth happened between Frost's incredible announcement and the finale? we, blacks, were undercut. A still-simmering Alderman Timothy Evans IV told me, "It's evident these people think that a black mayor and black voting power are just a temporary thing. They don't think Harold can keep up the momentum from his election. They think they're going to retake everything. I wouldn't want to promote talk of a third party or a black party," said Evans. "We're Democrats, and blacks have been consistently loyal Democrats. We're just talking fair, and the party ticket isn't fair to blacks, women, or Hispanics." Evans emerged as one of the slate-making session's orators, calling the ticket a replica of the Titanic. He could prove right. You can dismiss an alternate slate, or you can remember the lessons of last February and April, with its devastating black vote, a vote that should never be taken for granted again, even if it turns up short on occasion. The county campaign involves different geography, but it is already becoming as foul and divisive as the mayoralty.
And that will do it for this week. Next week we'll pick up on page 106, and we are slowly closing on the end of the book. Two, max three sessions, I would think, before we're able to wrap this one up. But that is this week. Folks, would like to dial in if you have comments you would like to share. The number to dial, 641-715-3640. The code is 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. All the folks that we had with us last time should be here. Caller on the vote line, Thomas in New York, Roz, and we also have, looks like, some new folks who joined as well. Caller at 9853, you should be with us, and I guess caller from a block number. We'll start with the new folks, and then we'll get the folks who are still with us from the first time that we shared. So 9853 and caller from a block number, if you two wanted to start us off, you had things you wanted to share.
Oh, this is 9853 from Colorado.
Oh, our narrator, right on.
Yes, good evening. just wanting to chime in about some of the commentary from the piece that you read before this last segment, when you were talking about how you kind of laid out a process of perhaps Ms. McClain had been on this mission to present herself as neutral and really believing in integration with whites and like really putting all of her energy and effort into that. And then beginning to come to awareness after the election of Mayor Harold Washington. And that was my thought exactly as I was doing the reading I've been reading the different essays, is that this woman is in public and she is coming to awareness. And I think that she is completely caught off guard. It seems like she's also completely overwhelmed. And yet she also seems like she cannot, she can't unsee what she's seeing. Like she's beginning to know, and she's got to figure out what to do. Like she's on this public stage. As all of this is unfolding, this is her, she's watching this political process, but it's also her own personal process. And I'm also kind of speaking, you know, as a person that works in mental health. But that to me seems like what I'm witnessing. And I reached the same conclusion that you did, Gus. I think that had a huge impact on her mental health, and ultimately contributed greatly to her suicide. Those are my thoughts, and I'll mute my line.
Gratitude again for investing the time in doing the reading for us. Exceptional work. And yeah, that's one I will ask folks to ponder on as we continue to move through the reading. The person that called in, I guess you had a block number. Did you have commentary you wanted to share also?
Yes, everyone. Good evening, Gus. And I want to add my thanks to the caller for doing the reading also. That's very hard work. It is an investment. So it's karma. And, you know, I was just sitting here saying, oh, I can't wait to see how this works out with Mayor Washington. But we already know how it works out because Mayor Washington, he doesn't survive it. So, you know, that was disheartening. But I was just saying, oh, I wonder how he fixes all these problems, how he makes everything work out. But he never does. He never does. But I'm kind of torn because, you know, I have my philosophies that I work by. And one of my philosophies is that at first, you know, you used to say, I used to hear you, everybody say, words are so important, words are so important. And I'm more of an action person. And I'm like, oh, it's giving too much credence to words. Good grief, let's do something. But you're right. Words are really important. And I've come around to seeing that. And so when she was reading the analysis from the article by Kaufman, and he was saying how we interpret words differently as Black people, that's something different than other what I was thinking. I was thinking that white people are just doing what they always do. They just weaponize everything. They weaponize water. They weaponize the schools. They weaponize words. Whereas we use words for communication. For them, words are tools of assault. But the way he was saying it, so maybe I actually have to rethink that. I'm going to have to rethink that. Maybe there's just something really fundamental. But weaponizing words is really fundamental. So, and also, when he was talking about, you know, when Black people say, you know, people do this, and white people will go like, they'll all take that as an insult, even if you weren't talking about all of them. That happened to someone I was very close with this weekend. She was speaking in church, and she was talking about how the school board is, you know, they're basically mistreating the children. And there was one white person in church. Now, I'm against that. But there was one white person in church, she said, and she said, and that woman just made a beeline for her and said, who do you mean by they? Describe they. Who do you mean by they? What do you mean by they? You know, and my friend was just like so taken aback by that. And then a Black man jumped to her defense. So she was really floored by that one. But and that reminded me of that, so I wanted to share that. That may be useful to someone. But the weapon thing, the words are weapons versus words are just processed differently. I don't know. That's very interesting. Okay, that's all I had to say.
Right on. The other folks, Roz, Thomas in New York, caller on the vote line, if you all had commentary as well, feel free. If there's anybody else who has not shared and you think there's something that you want to add, if you could get your hand up like now, that would be better than waiting until the end. Thank you kindly. The other folks, feel free.
Can you hear me? Ahead?
Yes, sir.
Hi. Greenies, and I wanted to say thank you for the sister for the reading. It was very well done, and I appreciate that. And also her insight, I echo that as well as what you shared as well, Gus. I believe that that awakening to the reality of what it means to be white definitely, I believe, heavily contributed to her suicide. It kind of made me think of Khalif Browder, and the reason why is because you know, they kept him in jail. They offered him the ability to be free, but to ruin his life by taking a plea, which he refused because he knew he didn't do anything wrong. And then just the ideology of that they could just open the doors to the jail and let him go home. And he's probably thinking in his mind, why didn't you do that 3 years ago when I told you I didn't take this backpack? You know, and just the psychological damage that white people play on us, just something as simple as that, pushed him over the edge. So imagine this Black female who is successful, you know, coming out of a basically a low-income Black environment, becoming successful, quote-unquote, whatever that means, in the white world, as whites would see it, and then suffering from the trauma of waking up to that reality. Because I'm sure, especially now that we know her great-grandparents, two of them are white, it probably gave her the idea in her mind that, well, I'm a byproduct of race mixing, so it can't be a bad thing. I mean, I'm not that bad, you know. So in her mind, it must be that much harder to indict the same people who, you know, just a couple generations ago, you had, you know, a white pair of white great grandparents. So I think absolutely you were right with that. On page 98, she shares something really interesting. She says there's a deeper and dangerous psychological factor at play in the council wards, especially when the fighting gets this dirty. Any reform mayor would have had a battle on his hands, but Mayor Washington's foes are emboldened in their sniping because of his color. That is the way it is in this world. Whether whites can see it or not, or admit it or not, they are ingrained by this society with a superior attitude toward blacks that is as natural and reflexive and uncontrollable as sneezing. That means that a black mayor is fair game for the most vile public insults, as Vrdoljak showed. And to me, that speaks like to right there. She just hammered it in about what it means to be white and the fact that it's almost in their DNA. When she said this as reflexive and uncontrollable as sneezing, there's an understanding. I don't know when she wrote this, and as far as the timeline after she wrote How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Blacks and how close it was to her passing, but that was just such an eloquent snippet of some insight that was very profound in the midst of all of that confusion. And then there was something she had said on the following page, and it's very brief, but she says, it started on the page before. She says, the council is still dotted with crooks and hacks on both sides who suddenly became legislators after Washington's election. They probably called Mayor Jane Byrd a shrew or worse in her early feisty days, or called Michael Blandick a wimp, but it was done behind their backs. Sexism against Byrne is yet a valid topic. And I just see the beginnings of conflation, just that whole idea of adding, sexism now to the race issue. And that also shows a semblance of confusion just in that fact. And it made me think of an article I read. It was called Black Women, Feminism, the CIA, and Gloria Steinem. And in the article, they discussed about how Gloria Steinem was paid by the CIA to facilitate the feminist movement amongst black women to perpetuate lesbianism and to destroy the black family. And it was one of many articles I came across when I did that search. So I encourage people who are maybe studying the history of feminism to look into that, because it was a ruse as far as what it was doing to the black family and how it was presented and the reasons it was presented to black women at the time that it was, and that Gloria Steinem was a CIA agent. Also, I found this telling too on page 99. She says, every politician is required to have a spat with journalists. The mayor was on target about the cultural unfamiliarity, but that would apply to blacks about Ukrainians too. And I just find it interesting that she always finds a way to indict black people or say black people also have, you brought it up earlier in the discussion this evening, have tendencies to be racist as well. And then, on the following page where she talks about, Cockman, and she says Cockman shows how language compounds racial divisions. Among his data are that interruption of another speaker is unacceptable in debate amongst whites, yet perfectly all right among blacks. That if the volume of debate rises, whites perceive a threat, while blacks just see an exciting exchange. That in the white culture, to go so far as to voice a threat means that the next step is carrying it out, while just voicing it is a sufficient release for blacks. That whites do not mind direct personal questions on a first meeting, but blacks do. And that a white wrongly accused will rise to defend himself, while the black view is that to protest too much affirms the guilt. I find a lot of that, a lot of misinformation in that, because I've seen white people, especially among the debate with Donald Trump, you saw a right fit to interject, and they do it amongst each other all the time. So I don't know if he created his work to confuse people, but that I don't find to be true. When he says, if the volume of a debate rises, whites perceive a threat, while blacks just see it as an exciting exchange, I find that to be fairly accurate. But when he says that in white culture, to go so far as to voice a threat means that the next step is carrying it out, while just voicing it is a sufficient release for blacks, that's completely inaccurate, because we see black people, just Chicago, take that for example, we brutalize each other all the time, so we carry out these threats as well. I find it to be a lot of just misinformation on certain levels, and just suggestive racism in the way that it's presented in that sense. And then further down, where I think Karma brought it up, where where she writes, because all blacks who fit the, all whites who fit the genetic criteria feel themselves accused, not just those who are guilty. Those who regard themselves as innocent will demand redress from the accuser. With the black cultural perspective, however, there can be no inadvertent hits. For people to admit that they feel accused is by that fact alone to acknowledge their guilt. Kuckman's theory was proved at City Hall, at a City Hall press conference in which reporters pressed the mayor for the most picayune specifics as to which whites in the media he was accusing. They all felt accused. And that just speaks to what I've talked about before when I say white people function as a racist white supremacist superorganism. So when you do bring out racism, white supremacy, all of them are going to be offended because they're all racist white supremacists. Whereas with black people today, the way that we are programmed, we look at everything on an individual basis, and we'll somehow filter out that there's some good whites out there that we'll associate with and have friends with, and then there's good bad whites, and then there's bad blacks who mistreat us, and then there's good blacks who do. And I think that is one of the biggest detriments to the way that we are have been trained psychologically to perceive the world around us and perceive white people, because they function in that holistic super organism sort of mentality. They view us as the super organism that can bring about their genetic annihilation, which is why they are so thorough at abusing and killing us at will. And we have to start viewing them the way that they view us. I won't speak too much longer because I know other people want to chime in too, but I had a couple other things, but I'll hold off on it. Thank you very much.
For sure. Thomas in New York, caller from the vote line.
Yes, I wanted to make a comment. Mr. Renegade. Oh, and I want to thank the other caller for reading the piece as well, because I didn't have an opportunity to read it myself. But the comment that you made before the second segment, I wanted to echo some of the things you said and just really bring a couple of points, just highlight them based on my experience. So the mental health state of this author, I think it's really amplified compared to perhaps what each of us may have experienced when we sort of began to come out of our confusion and gain a high level of consciousness. So I've seen the picture of this author, and I had a hard time determining whether she was white or black. And the point that you made that she has two grandparents or great-grandparents that were white really explained a lot. And I think I read that maybe her mother was albino. So certainly her level of mental health and the investment, emotional investment she had in the integration was probably paramount. She came to the realization that her skin color did not prevent her from experiencing the significant levels of racism because she was still considered black. And so that had to be completely devastating to her. And I can somewhat relate to that. I don't look like her. And maybe some of us other victims can relate to that, because as you begin to learn what the system is really like, and all the things that are composed in it, it's very painful, and it's hard for us to accept that, you know, these people, white people, could just have such vitriol against us, each individual one, and that's an incredibly painful process. And what I believe is that those of us non-white people, when we begin to hear more about the system, we do not want to accept that. We want to believe that they're good. We want to believe that we can trust an individual one. It's just these other people out here, you know, the KKK, the people with the hoods, and they call us niggers. We want to believe that so deeply, because to not believe that, we have to go through that painful process of accepting it and then doing something about it. And we resist that. I've tried to have conversations with my family, as I keep pointing out, I'm still coming out of my own confusion, and they really hold on to that fact, but I feel like I'm sort of making some headway. So just to, again, just to sum it up and let other people discuss as well, it's just a process of not wanting to go through that painful process. And I think we're so damaged that either many of us, we attack each other. We know that looking at the violence in some of our major cities, and some of us, it's just sort of, we have this death wish, and she acted on hers. And some of us, unfortunately, do that every day because we just go out and kill each other. We have the self-hate when we accept the fact of our reality, but we have to find a way to move past that. I know we don't qualify for black mental health, but I think that her story just amplifies what we all have to go through as we become more have a better understanding of racism, white supremacy, and just getting through that process. So we have to think about how do we get others to come to this awareness and sort of guide them through the pain of just having to accept the reality of the system, and that each individual white person, they are the building blocks of racism, white supremacy, and they're the ones who keep it going. And it's incredibly painful for us to accept.
Ah, shame. Thomas in New York.
Have you heard?
Yes, sir.
Oh, okay, good evening once again. Great comments from everyone, I think. I just wanted to say, man, with a guy, when she read the part, I don't know if it was something she wrote, but I think Karma was kind of touching on it. But she said, as far as conduct, and blacks are happy with the emotional response, but when whites say something, they mean it, so they can't have those type of arguments and things going on amongst each other. And I found that to be very interesting, because I find that, you know, we're sometimes happy with the argument, but they always have to go that extra mile with it. And just thought that was very interesting. And I think that, you know, she suffered from depression, but also she suffered from white validation disease. You know, here she is, this successful black woman. And I looked at the picture of her. I didn't get anything other than like a light skin, or what would you call a red bone, or high yellow black woman. Like, I didn't get anything that would make me think she was a white woman at all. But I think that, you know, here she's this highly educated. She has this esteemed position. You know, she's light skinned. And, you know, she's been getting a lot of validation from whites probably for years, you know, going to college with them, feeling like, you know, things are changing, it's getting different. Also having white family members who probably treated her very nice, you know, they're very very slick with that, you know. And, probably felt like she had a extreme amount of white validation, and the figure had that epiphany moment where it's like, boom, oh, sweat, all these people all this time are racist. I think that had to weigh heavy, you know, with her depression as well. You know, it's like you've been living a lie, you know, your whole life, your whole career. Everyone around you now is a suspect, you know, and just not having any type of codification to prepare for that, or how to handle that, it had to weigh heavy, especially if you're already depressed. Like they said, like you said last week, or her husband said she was already tried to commit suicide once before or whatever. I mean, I could see that just being like, just really weighing in that final straw. I'll mute my line on that. Thank you very much.
Right on. Some of the things that stood out in the passage, see how quickly I can get through it. Number one, for Roz, where he was talking about politics, is war. This period in Chicago, with all of the white supremacy conflict directed at Harold Washington, the city was nicknamed Beirut by the Lake. And this nickname apparently has stuck. It still comes up. If you check online, you'll see this. They even were saying now that the mayor's Rahm Emanuel, that, you know, Chicago is no longer Beirut by the Lake. But this was the way the city was known. And because of racism, white supremacy, not a spat between black people and white people, but white people terrorizing black people during this period of time. So just wanted to make sure I got that in. As I said, there's a lot of research if you want to do more on what was going on in Chicago in this period of time. The study by Thomas Cockman, I think quite a few people have referenced that. I'm of the opinion that this is not familiar, or a lack of familiarity, a lack of understanding between white people. I see that same concept being put forward to explain this. This is not white people don't understand black people, or we have different communication styles. That's not what is happening here. This is racism, white supremacy, and specifically in this essay about the elocution style of Harold Washington. If he's pointing out, hey, I think in terms of white people in the media, I think that they are having racist response, that is dictating what they say about me, how they quote me, that sort of thing. That's just white people practicing racism. That's not any sort of, oh, well, we just have a different communicate. That's not what is happening at all. And I feel like that's just another one of those methods where white people, they're able to practice racism and they're able to excuse it in some other fashion. I did, and I think this is kind of similar to the point that Thomas in New York was raising. I do think that when he was talking about the difference in black people, they are okay just making the threat, whereas whites, if the threat is made, they feel like they're going to go through on. I think that in the system of white supremacy, white people are able to go through on those threats. They don't just have to sit around and casually toss words. They can make things happen, whatever that's going to be. Whereas black people, we are in a much weaker position. So it might just be, you know, talking and saying a whole lot, but just not having the wherewithal to follow through on their threats. But the rest of it, I mean, that's what I mean. Not even digging into it. That's not the problem when we're talking about racism, white supremacy. I did think the other aspect in terms of white people responding to an allegation, I think it's specific and exclusive to if there is an allegation of racism, then you will see that response where any and all white people feel indicted because it's true in a system of white supremacy. Like, wait a minute, you're not supposed to be calling us out for practice. That's not supposed to be happening. They are supposed to do that. And in my view, that's just another act of racism. When they have those type of responses, I think some of that has happened on this program and we've had white guests. In fact, you can even relate it, in my view, to President Obama in 2009 when he spoke up about what happened to Dr. Henry Louis Gates at Harvard and saying that that officer acted stupidly. And he didn't even say that the officer was racist. He just said that he acted stupidly. And he mentioned racial profiling, where you had this widespread outrage. And oh, my gosh, I think Van Jones comment, he said it was terror. And that's the specific term that he used. He said it was terrorism. He had never seen anything like the response after President Obama said that. When you get that response from white people, that is them practicing racism to defend their system and to obfuscate their terroristic conduct. We are not supposed to be indicted. People are not supposed to be talking about the psychosis of the white collective. You're supposed to be talking about anything else. Black people need to pull up their pants and stop smoking weed and feeding their children fried chicken and whatever else you want to talk about. Not this is our fault and white people are participating in this and I'm going to make a correct indictment of the white global collective. That's never supposed to happen. And if it is, you are supposed to be challenged. So I did think that that was significant, important. I think Roz pointed out the passage where she was being correct, and just to timestamp that article from page 96, that article was written roughly 3 months after the piece that she wrote, How Chicago Taught Me to Hate Whites, where she was being extremely accurate, in my opinion, for the most part, about racism and what it means to be white. And that essay, it's The Spoils of War, Chicago Style, that essay was roughly 7 months, 7 to 8 months before her suicide. So you can kind of process that as well. The snippet where she talked about for white people being racist and attacking Harold Game, he was quote unquote fair game, that was as natural as sneezing. I think that might have been another snippet along the way of the difficulty of accepting what it means to be white and how that was impacting her writing and her mental health over the next few months before her suicide. Anything else I wanted to make sure I got in? Where she says everyone and no one, this is on page 96. I thought that was, this is the top of 96, excuse me. And this is, incidentally, it's right after that paragraph. So she makes that comment about, you know, it's acceptable to go after, or excuse me, it's at the top of the page. It's before she gets to the comment about it's acceptable to go after Mayor Washington as it is sneezing. But she says, who is to blame? Everyone and no one. No side has a monopoly on truth or the public interest. These are warring politicians, after all. Besides a few zoning or contract decisions left unsettled, it's not hurt day-to-day business. In my view, that's another one of those of everyone is to blame, no one is to blame. Black people are also complicit in this, and not squarely saying that the people that are most to blame for all of this are white. I also thought it was interesting where she was talking about Alderman Frost. This is a little bit later in the segment that we did, the second audio segment, where apparently he was going to see if, hey, maybe I can work with the Verdoliak 29. And then he ended up getting nothing. He was, I guess, going to run for the, was it Office Record of Deeds, the Office of Deeds, and Alderman Wilson Frost, that's it. And he was going to Recorder of Deeds office. That was what he was going to run for. He ended up getting nothing, and they kind of left him out of the proposal. I think this is just another example, in my opinion. White people, because they are in charge, I think I said after the first audio segment that this Verdoliak 29, that this is just a white gang on a local level. Chicago is infamous for white gangs. That, hey, we are in power. We can get other black people because we have more power to serve our interests, work against other black people, and then we're just going to mistreat them too. Once we're done and we've, you know, got our objectives accomplished, we can cast them to the wayside as well. And that seems to be what happened with Alderman Wilson Frost, where she said by the time the slate was drawn, Frost was absent from it and looking strangely like a tragic figure, again, at the hands of Verdoliak, who had been described as an old buddy of Frost's, with friends like that, where apparently, you know, this is my white friend, again, foiled by white friends. I did think it, as well, the essay, it reminded me a lot of what we're seeing right now, the real secret weapon of the GOP. I think I have heard people say the exact same thing about President Obama. Now that you have both the House and the Senate dominated by white Republicans, suspected race soldiers, the Tea Party, Donald Trump, people saying that President Obama was the catalyst for all of this that we have seen over the last 8 years. And I think this is just the same point that a lot of folks have made throughout the readings. I will stop there. Anything folks want to make sure they got in before we wrap things up?
Yeah, I have one more thing to say, because they added this in the first chapter, I think, when they had the 19 or 18 people all running for his office seat. Mm. And one of the people said they wanted to knock down the Robert Taylor housing project. And I just started chuckling because in 1995, when I went to Chicago, that was still there, and they were debating about it then, knocking it down, and they did 3 years later start knocking them down. But, I mean, you talk about, like, huge 28 buildings, I mean, big buildings. And, I mean, it was a sight that I always remember, like, wow, you know, because I guess when you're black and you come from the so-called hood, you know, the first thing you realize is the projects when you see them. And that was one that was a sight to be seen. And it was funny how they mentioned that. And I said, man, they was trying to knock it down all the way since Harold Washington. And I guess whatever administration was in the 90s got it done. And I'll meet my line. Thank you.
Mayor Daley, who's been mentioned in this book, the son of the former Mayor Daley, but he took over eventually and was mayor for, I think, 20 years. He served as mayor. Anybody else have anything briefly they want to get in before?
Yes, I had a couple of things I wanted to get in. First, I wanted to say the Mr. Frost, I remember he actually said at one point, you guys promised that a black person would get that position. So he kind of approached it almost like a slave saying, well, master, you said that you would allow one of us to sit in that seat. So to me, he seemed like he had an idea that things might not go as he might have planned, even though that was his quote-unquote white friend. Just from that phrase alone, I wanted to chime in on that. And then also, I found that she made a very brilliant analysis on 104 where she says, what is so awesome about Harold Washington's presence that he turns Democrats to Republicans as the mythical Medusa turned people who looked upon her to stone? Could it be something about the way Harold Washington looks too? Face it, Chicagoans, there is something about the way Washington looks. and you only get one guess as to what it is. Harold Washington is one Sharpie recruiting so many white people for the GOP all in 1 year. I thought that was a brilliant analysis, and I found it telling that she used the term Sharpie because Sharpies are also black markers. So I don't know what she meant when she used that term, but when she used the term one Sharpie, it just stood out to me. And then the last thing was on page 105, where she said, why is it that ethnicity was fine in the days when the ticket had its quota of Irish, Italians, Germans, Poles, or whatever, but not now when blacks want in? Suddenly, it's qualifications that count. Come on, we're talking tradition, except that blacks know all too well how traditions are disavowed in a split second when they begin to take advantage of them, qualifications or no. To me, that just says, what does it mean to be white? Because all of those people she named, Irish, Italians, Germans, Poles, all of them were in the club. Poles were allowed into the white club. Italians were eventually allowed into the white club. Irish were eventually allowed into the white club. They all came together as one racist superorganism and said, kick the niggas out. So I just found that to be very interesting as well. And that was all I wanted to chime in with. Thank you.
For sure. Anything else folks want to make sure they get in concisely before we conclude?
I have one comment, Beth.
Yes, ma'am.
Oh, about the black and white styles in conflict. I think that what's really like there right under the surface, but that doesn't get stated clearly in the article, where they're talking about the difference. She's talking about the difference between accusations and allegations, whether they're categorical or general. It's sort of like what Mr. Fuller will talk about, and he will say, you know, white people, because of the power dynamics, they are the ones who categorize. And so when black people start to issue, like, statements versus questions and, you know, making statements where we are categorizing, I think it triggers like an automatic reflex in white people where they're like, wait a minute. And then they flip into the question mode of, who do you mean when you're saying they? And they go on and on. And I've been in dialogues like that. So, but I think that is really more about white power and them saying, we are the ones who categorize. You're not the ones who categorize. So that was my final observation.
For sure. For sure. Just two quick points I wanted to add in before we wrap things up. The first one, right after the points that Raj just brought out on 104 from the essay, The Real Secret Weapon of the GOP, where she made the reference that Harold Washington is the Sharpie that's motivating all this white political activity. Right after that, she says, and white is apparently what the Republicans want. At the recent meeting of the Republican Governors Association, members were urged not to waste their time to pursue the black vote, but to go after Hispanics, Asians, and white ethnics. Illinois Governor James Thompson told the gathering his black votes last November were inconsequential. This is inconsequential in number, not in importance, he quickly recovered. That, I think, is pretty substantial, and I think even you see some of that today, 2016 presidential election, at least from the quote-unquote GOP side. The other comment, the essay that she wrote, Washington's Electrifying Elocution, this reminded me of the essay was on Jesse Jackson, but she just had a part at the end where she was talking about him running for president, and she was saying that he was kind of street. I'm paraphrasing, but she did use the term street, that he was kind of street and maybe not suited for the office of the presidency. And I commented on it at the time and saying, to me, this seems like some of our victimization and how we have been misled to think about whites as being dignified and gentlemanly. And nothing could be further from the truth. These folks are total psychopaths in the way that they function. If you want to go back to Andrew Jackson, I commented on it before, but even in that speech where she's talking about Harold Washington and the way that he talks, and maybe she ends it by saying, hush your mouth, because of the way that he talks is not fitting of the mayor's office. And I just said, man, I mean, if you think about the conduct, if we're just talking about speech of white elected officials, if we want to talk about crack smoking Rob Ford, the mayor in Chicago who just died this week, if we want to talk about Donald Trump and the things that he has said and his conduct on his run for presidency. If we want to talk about white elected officials, Dick Cheney cursing out other members, other elected officials and doing this publicly, the whites who were yelling at President Obama, "You lied," during the State of the Union address, and not to mention Ben Tillman brawling on the floor of the Senate. I mean, it is just boundless, their misconduct and their total lack of civility. Strom Thurmond, particularly when they were less refined, more explicit about racism, white supremacy, and just giving their open views on niggers. I have just seen tons of examples. Just how much time we want to invest in citing examples. But that would just be another one for me where it's somehow, well, black people, we just need to get our behavior together and behave correctly. We're not looking. White people are not models of behavior at all. Like, no, forgetting the fact that they're practicing racism. But I mean, just analyzing what we see on a regular daily basis. These folks are no one to compare yourself to say, oh, man, they've set the standard for conduct as a mayor, or as an elected official. Nothing could be further from the truth. And I will stop there. We'll pick up next week. As I said, we're more than halfway through the book, maybe 2-3 sessions left. If there's anything that you want to contribute, if you can't trip in live, you can drop an email and we'll just read it as we proceed. We should be here tomorrow. Compensatory call in 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on what happened the last 7 days, workplace racism. Folks have anything that they'd like to share, we'll look forward to hearing from you tomorrow, roughly 24 hours. If you have questions, problems, gripes, suggestions, feel free to drop an email untiljustice@gmail.com, untiljustice@gmail.com. With that, thanks everyone for contributing, tuning in. Again, thanks to our narrators, folks who have done a great job investing their time reading this material and sharing the book. I am super appreciative, and because I didn't have to read the book, narrate the book. With that, creator, number one, sobriety would be best under conditions of white terrorism. Definitely, let's make sure that we're making great decisions to keep ourselves safe and other victims that we might be responsible for. If you're going to be a driver, passenger, pedestrian, make sure you are not under the influence. I know the weather is warming up and people want to go out and have fun, frolic a little bit. You still want to be codified. You never know when it will be Daniel Holtzclaw, Darren Wilson, who is pulling you over. They could not just end your life in the next 5 minutes, but cause you a lot of problems that could dog you for the rest of your existence. Just keep that in mind. Make smart decisions when we go out. With that, creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, your brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.